lovely Minnesota day. As you may see, I don't know if everybody has seen the agenda and the testifiers that are on the agenda, but you will realize quickly if you see that agenda why we hold interim hearings sometimes. And that is, I think we have 190 testifiers or something. It's actually probably more like 30, 20, something like that. But these are issues that are important issues and sometimes have some complexities that actually lend themselves to interim hearings where we have a little bit more time to get more testimony and have more questions and things like that. So I appreciate everybody's coming in during the interim to hear these issues. We're going to kick it off by hearing from our friends at the Minnesota Lottery. I believe, gentlemen, Mr. Van Petten, you have a little bit of a presentation about where, kind of a little overview of where things are at, and then are available for questions that members may have.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And gentlemen, if I don't know who's going to kick it off, but if you can just, you've been through this drill before, if you can just identify yourselves for the record and then proceed, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Ed Van Petten. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. And to my right is Don Feeney, who is the Director of Research and Planning for the Minnesota State Lottery. Is Jenny here? Okay. Well, we may have Jenny Canfield here. She's Director of Operations. I thought there may be, she won't be presenting, however, I thought there may be some questions a little more technical than I could answer, so I asked her to be here also. And with that, the presentation will center around what we're doing on the Internet with our Play at the Pump initiative and selling at ATMs. I would pretty happy to report last year our sales were up about $40 million from the year before. We've had 6 years in a row of increased sales, and I can't take any credit for that because I've only been here about a year and a half, but things are running well. And for this year, we're running ahead of last year by about 4% so far. So things are running pretty well. First thing I'd like to point out is why would we want to sell our product on the Internet? And first slide will show you that over the past few years, customers have increasingly expected their goods to be available on the Internet, with an estimate for the year 2014 at $224 billion in sales, that up from 2002 and $42 billion in sales. We researched our player demographics and have found that in the 18 to 24 age group in 2003, 52% reported purchasing a lottery ticket, at least occasionally. In 2012, our research showed that it dropped to 29% in that age group, and 25 to 34-year age group dropped from 45% to 48%. 68 to 45, sorry. And, you know, there are a number of reasons for this decline, but we found the main reason is that the belief is that the lottery is not available in the places where these age groups shop. In fact, one research study out of Massachusetts showed that 55% of the 18 to 24-year-olds report that they never go in stores where lottery is offered. Well, we know they do because they go in convenience stores. Therefore, the only assumption can be that we're just not on their radar. They just walk past lottery without even seeing it. Minnesota Lottery first began Internet sales of its online products, which are the draw games, in November of 2010. We set a maximum spending limit of $50 a week. Players can lower that limit, however, they cannot exceed the $50 limit. We have a cooling off period that if they have a lower limit set and decide to raise that limit, they cannot purchase right away. They have to have a cooling off period. And that's due to, you know, research that shows the greatest risk of overspending is when you're increasing those limits. We track the wager history, and as you know, none of that is really possible on any other medium other than the Internet. This shows a picture of the homepage for our subscription sales and lists the products available, and the player just clicks on the draw game that they choose to purchase. The next is our first proposed electronic instant ticket. That game has not launched yet. We're looking at later on in the fall. As you can see, the electronic ticket will be virtually the same as the paper ticket. With regard to any internet sales, we believe that it is all incremental sales. For every $1 of internet sales, we've experienced a $217 growth at the retail brick and mortar side. And internet sales at this time represents about a 0.2% of total sales.
Wow.
We believe that the internet has a positive influence on retailer sales, and that's due simply to brand awareness. Multi-channel strategy broadens the demographic base, exposes our product to more people. By increasing the awareness, we feel that it translates to purchases in-store and increases our accessibility to millions of players. This screen shows a sample of couponing that we intend to do with our retailers. We have the ability to vary the couponing by zip code, so we can promote various retailers in various areas of the state to try to draw our players into their establishments. In Europe, research has shown that in the countries or jurisdictions that have internet sales of these products, retail sales have grown by 11%, while jurisdictions without internet accessibility have grown 5%. So that shows a 6% increase with regard to lotto-style games. Our scratch games show an increase in internet jurisdictions of 38% as opposed to 28%. This slide shows different countries. To me, the most interesting is in Great Britain, which I suppose would be the most similar culturally to us. In the past 4 years, lottery sales have increased by $1.2 billion, and they are fully accessible on the internet. And during that time period, retailers' commissions have increased by 21%. Belgium and Finland also have shown growth, with Finland showing a growth of 1 billion euro. 67% of that growth was at retail, and Belgium increased by 16%, with 73% of that increase at retail. In British Columbia, they in 2011 introduced full casino style games on the internet, and as you'll see, their retail sales have increased with that introduction. E-gaming was introduced in 2006, and retail sales remained fairly steady during that time period. The retail is showing annual growth at this time of about 4%, and electronic gaming is showing stagnation in growth. I'll go on into our play at the pump. We had planned to expand the play at the pump this week with another manufacturer of POS materials, Gilbarco. We've pulled that back a couple weeks to do additional testing. However, we will roll out 12 more locations with that POS provider. Last year, you'll recall, we launched a pilot program of 9 locations with a different POS provider, Verifone. There have been some software issues with their equipment, and it had nothing to do with the lottery, but we have remained at those 9 locations but chosen not to expand until we're sure that everything is functioning properly. With the play at the pump, also the average retailer engaged in the play at the pump, it is a very small study, but they have shown a 2% increase in draw-type sales as opposed to retailers that do not have that available. And as you'll see on that slide also, the Minnesota Service Station Association has endorsed the program, saying we are constantly looking for ways to increase revenues. This program always allows us to reach customers who never enter our stores. And I know Mr. Tom is here from the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers. They do not endorse the program. However, we have been quite friendly, and I'll report to you we still are discussing our differences. summary, we feel that multi-channel strategy is beneficial to Minnesota. Our main goal is to increase our revenues to the state of Minnesota, but do so with transparency and integrity, and we intend to do that. We'll continue to develop new distribution methods in an attempt to increase those funds. We feel strongly that an online presence generates brand awareness in our product and therefore will increase sales at the retail level also. And you should know and probably have heard that the federal government is continually introducing additional legislation to limit the state's rights to develop internet protocols. And to this date, anyway, every one of those has grandfathered in what states have developed thus far. We feel that we owe it to the state of Minnesota to develop these protocols to where we can sell our product on the internet so we will not be restricted by later federal legislation. And Mr. Feeney has prepared, at the chair's request, a presentation regarding internet poker. However, that's something we aren't involved in, and I thought perhaps I should stand for questions on these subjects at this time.
That's fair. And thank you, Mr. Van Petten, for the overview. Maybe as a segue to what Mr. Feeney is going to talk about, I'm sure members like on this committee have heard the same thing. I think internet gaming is on its way back in some fashion. I don't know when, and I don't know who's going to run it. It's my understanding that it's actually taking place in the so-called deep web, which I don't pretend to understand, but that it's still occurring in states across the country in an ongoing illegal fashion. Gentlemen, if you could take out your crystal ball and 5 years from now, what the status of internet gaming, this is on internet poker, but internet gaming, what's it going to look like 5 years from now, and who's going to run it?
Mr. Chairman, Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director, Minnesota State Lottery. I'm going to go to my first slide here because I think that'll help with that. 2012, internet gambling worldwide was a $33 billion a year business. And in the U.S., where in 2012 there was no internet gambling that was, legality is questionable, but it's not clearly illegal, but certainly it is all unregulated, $2.6 billion a year. There is kind of this impression that we have outlawed internet gambling. We haven't. We certainly, and to the extent that we have attempted to, we have not done it effectively. If you think that somehow we can ban internet gambling, that horse has left the barn. It's left the barn a long time ago. It is out there. It in the U.S. It is happening now entirely in a completely unregulated manner, almost exclusively with offshore sites of kind of dubious reputation, to say the least. In Europe, it is, and in Canada, it is, however, widespread. Again, with differing degrees of regulation, there are jurisdictions where it is very, very closely regulated. There are jurisdictions where it is not, and the range of games offered covers basically anything that you could do in a land-based casino, and then some. It has not taken over the gambling world, though, by any means. Internet gambling, there were predictions that I could show you from like 2009, 2010, that the moment it was out there, it was going to be the killer app of the internet, and that it was going to lead to widespread worldwide gambling addiction. And that none of that has happened. I think some of that has to do with distrust of the operation, certainly. I mean, fundamentally, at this point, you're playing dice with, you know, you're playing somebody who has invisible dice. You're trusting some operator in Aruba or wherever it is to conduct a fair game and determine the outcome, fairly to both you and them. And that's a pretty big leap of faith to some people. I think the other factor, though, which I think is a little more significant, is that people aren't finding internet gambling to be as much fun as the real thing. Keith White, who's the executive director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, recently said, internet gambling is gambling minus everything that makes it fun. And if you think about that, so much of, you know, going to the casino is being in that social environment, whether you're there with friends or not. So much of playing poker is being able to look at the other players. Maybe you're playing with friends, maybe you're playing in terms of just be able to watch the other players and thinking that, you know, you are somehow analyzing them and looking for their little giveaways and whatever. And on the internet, that becomes an exercise really in just measuring probabilities. It's not nearly as much fun. There was a study done in England where they went out and interviewed a very large number of people about their gambling, some of whom gambled on the internet, some of them who didn't. And the people who didn't gamble on the internet said, again, it's because it's not nearly as much fun. The people who did gamble on the internet said, it's their second best. It's what they do, particularly the heavy gamblers said, it's what I do when I can't make it to the casino or the betting shop. And that's all. It's an auxiliary activity. So it is going to grow. There are going to be more forms of gambling available on the internet. It is not going to, in any way, shape, or form, replace traditional gambling in the settings that we know. And in fact, that everything that I've seen suggests that those settings are going to continue to thrive.
Thank you, Mr. Feeney. And I expect we'll go through your presentation in a minute. We will have some questions. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if members would look at, I don't know if every member has or not, but I've just been reading through a memorandum I received from dated February 11, 2012, and where the lottery seems to be believing they have some authority to do some of these things. First of all, the statement that was just made regarding dollars spent on gaming on the internet will not replace other forms of gaming. I don't know how anyone could draw that conclusion. If I have a dollar, of course I wouldn't spend money on gaming anyways, but if I was somebody that was entertainment for me, I take a dollar and I can put on the internet, or I can go to a casino, or I can go do some pull tabs or something like that. I don't know how anyone can say that if you're spending money gaming on the internet that it's not going to affect other types of gaming. I don't understand that for a second. I don't believe that to be true. But on the document, and this is an amazing document if you read it, because basically it says the lottery can do whatever they want to, whenever they want to, and I have zero oversight, zero transparency, and this committee means nothing when it comes to gaming. That's what this document says. And if you go to page 4, I'm curious about page 4, slot machine type games. It says, slot machines constitute a lottery type game. So if they constitute it's widely assumed, I'm not sure who's assuming it, but the document says it's widely assumed under Minnesota law that slot machines constitute a lottery type game. If that's the case, why just the internet? Why not put slot machines at the gas pumps or slot machines in the restrooms at convenience stores? Put them everywhere you can. Because if we're saying that slot machines, it's widely assumed under Minnesota law, slot machines constitute a lottery type game, why just the internet? Why not set up a shop in downtown
Rosemount,
and put some machines up? What stops the lottery from putting actual slot machines up when it says you can do it? If you can do it on the internet, why can't you do it physically on that? And also, if you could please cite, when it says, since it is widely assumed under Minnesota law, could you cite the statute that gives you that assumption?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, as far as slot machines at the gas pump, et cetera, and bars, statute 39A.13 says, nothing in this chapter authorizes the director to install or operate a lottery device operated by coin or currency, which when operated determines the winner of a game. Therefore, slot machines are not legal, at least to be operated by the lottery. Of course, the legislature could authorize them. I have not talked to Mr. McDonald. That opinion was written before my tenure here. However, I read that to say that there could be ways on the internet to operate a slot-like machine or have the appearance of a slot-like machine as long as it wasn't operated by coin or currency at that time. Well, we have no, I mean, I know this probably doesn't mean much to you right now, but we have no intention of doing that.
Representative Davids.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just the thought that they're saying that they could do it, And when you cite the statute, you say coin or currency. Well, if you make an internet payment with a credit card, isn't that technically currency?
I believe so.
Representative David?
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, the memo says on paragraph 4 on page 4 that Minnesota law, the slot machines constitute a lottery-type game. The lottery may conduct slot-type games over the internet. But yet you're taking payment. So doesn't that violate the statute right there?
Mr. Van Petten?
I believe his thought was that you could load the game to play it later. Therefore, it was not operated by coin or currency. I don't quite understand how that could work, but you can load accounts on the internet when you operate. I don't shop on the internet very much, but I know you can give them a credit or debit card number to load your account and then go in later to utilize that currency.
Well,
we do not have that capability.
Excuse me.
And also, just to point out, we cannot use credit cards under Minnesota law. It would only be debit card or ACH transfers.
Representative Davidson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, ACH transfers and debit cards are a form of currency. I think anyone would agree with that. But if the member, I mean, this is actually kind of an interesting issue because I think it's bipartisan. This is not one where one party is going to line up on one side and one the other because, Mr. Chairman, the memo of February 11th, 2012, to me is horrifying. And the way it looks to me is that we have the lottery gone wild. Because they think that they can do anything they want at any time they want with no oversight from this committee. And I get a little touchy when it comes to overstepping this committee, as you are well aware. So I guess we'll just leave it for other questions, but I am very concerned about where this lottery is headed. And again, I could give my speech about being late to my Amway meeting because there's four cars ahead of me and they're all playing at the pump, and I just need to get to my Amway meeting. I'm out of gas. So we'll just leave it at that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Hoppe and then Representative Schoen is up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always interesting to follow Representative Davids. I want to echo some of his concerns. When we look at this memo, it seems like a lot of this has expanded really without us okaying it. And when we hear testimony that says we will continue to develop new distribution methods, I think we, you know, the committee probably should be taking a look at this and what's going on and what could potentially be going on. And Mr. Chair, I know he's not on the list, and I didn't talk to him ahead of time, but I see Mr. Lund sitting up there. I wonder if he would be willing to come down and just give a quick overview of his thoughts about developing new distribution methods.
Are you desiring that right now, or you want to take a couple questions first? I'm not saying that we don't have him come down.
No, I'll leave it at whatever you want to do, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Do you have any questions, specific questions at this point for Mr. Van Petten? All right, then. I'm sorry. We're only recognizing people with facial hair today. Representative Schoen, I noticed on this side, well, other than Sanders, I think you got. All right. So, words, all right. We're going to. All right. No Shave November started early for the GOP side. Again, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Petten, I don't probably express my disdain as colorfully as Representative Davids,
sure.
But we share it together, and I think you're well aware of that after we talked about it last year that Representative Davids and I were going to offer legislation to prevent this altogether. He was more so just concerned about his county and his gas pumps, but when I look at this memo, it says, if I'm not mistaken, when you talked about expanding to scratch tickets, is that at the pump? When I look at the last paragraph, so 1, 2, 3, 4, when you responded to Representative Davids on October 28th.
No, sir.
Paragraph 4, where is that at?
Scratch tickets will be on the website.
Okay. Well, then I'll leave it at that because there was some expansion issues that we had talked about. And even then I expressed to you and staff that, you know, what I was hearing, albeit new, that I'm new to the committee, but this committee, again, is pretty sensitive to changes in the regulation, kind of when we feel like we're being usurped about our concerns and desires from the people of Minnesota for what this is actually going to entail. So it kind of seems like maybe that might be the case. That's a little bit little disturbing.
Mr. Van Petten, response
Mr.
to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative. If I may, Mr. Chair, reflect part of our conversation Monday with regard to better communication with the committee. I do, on a weekly or at least biweekly basis, brief the governor's staff as to anything we're doing, and had assumed in the past that when I come before the committee to report in at the start of the session that we would update you on what our initiatives are. Representative Atkins has asked that we perhaps develop some kind of correspondence, maybe quarterly, perhaps more often if there's something to report to the committee, to keep you better informed as to what we are doing. And I'm more than happy to do that, and would more than happy to meet with any committee member, with the whole committee, answer an email, answer a letter at any time. If you feel that we are not keeping you informed, or if you just have questions or concerns, we have no intention whatsoever of hiding anything we're doing from anyone, especially this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Van Petten.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Van Petten, that sounds great. Communication is good because, quite frankly, at this point, it seems like all the only time that I ever hear of any changes is when we come to a meeting like this, and it's certainly a firestorm. That's for sure. So I appreciate your offer of communication. I think that would be a wise choice. It's not maybe a meeting between individual members every week, but we've got to fix something.
Thank you, Representative Sean. And before we, I'd like to turn to Mr. Feeney. I think perhaps after Mr. Feeney's presentation, we'll have Mr. Lund come down and give us a little perspective from the Allied Charities. The Monday conversation that I had with Mr. Van Petten and Mr. Feeney was simply that I've heard from members on this committee as well as outside this committee of a desire for greater communication. Some have taken it to the point of saying perhaps we ought to establish something formal to provide further oversight for gaming activities here in Minnesota. I look forward to hearing additional comments from members either here today or over the course of time. I shared that with the gentleman here from the lottery. I also requested formally for them to communicate with us more frequently and formally in order to try to stem some of these so that, it, as Representative Schoen said, so it's not, you know, we just get to a hearing and we hear about new things. But there's sort of a back and forth communication, and I appreciate Mr. Van Petten's willingness to engage in that. I asked Mr. Feeney to give us a little bit. I don't expect them to get into the internet, just so we're clear. I don't expect them to get into the internet poker business. The reason I raise it is because if other members are like me, I'm getting a number of emails from national sources saying it's coming, Congress is doing something, states are doing something, whatever. And I think rather than operate in the realm of, you know, a lot of different sources, I thought I would ask these guys, where do they think things are today, and where are they going, so that we're all on the same page in an effort to have some level of communication. And then after that, I'd like to ask Mr. Lund to come down, and we'll get a little perspective from where our charities are at. Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Internet poker, and internet gaming in general, has been the subject of a great deal of confusion at the federal level. And there are a number of statutes and rulings that seem to have an effect. For a long time, what was considered to be the governing statute was the Wire Act of 1960, which was basically an attempt by the federal government to ban organized crime who were doing sports bookmaking across using the telephone across state lines. And it refers specifically to sports betting. The Department of Justice later interpreted that to include any type of gambling and then also interpreted that what was drawn up as a statute covering telephone communications also covered internet communications. And by that rationale, the Department of Justice had stated that all internet gambling was illegal. Further, I think it was 2009, Congress passed as a last-minute insertion on an appropriations bill what's called the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, which a lot of people have interpreted saying that it bans internet gambling. It doesn't. It bans banks from taking transactions on illegal internet gambling. The problem being that there's no definition anywhere of what internet, of what illegal internet gambling is, and banks looked at that and said, now I've got to examine all of the financial records of my customers to see where they're placing their bets. And so it is still on the books. It's not proved terribly effective for anything, however, and enforcement has been kind of non-existent. But in December of 2011, the Department of Justice basically reversed their course, changed their interpretation of the Wire Act, and said the Wire Act actually means what it says. It only covers sports bookmaking. Therefore, states are free to authorize any type of internet gambling as long as it takes place within their borders and is limited to state residents. The prediction at that time was that that would lead to a rush of states enacting various kinds of internet gambling, and poker was widely considered to be the quote-unquote killer app, that was going to be where the biggest profit was and where all the action would be. Since that time, there have been any number of bills introduced in Congress to limit the state's ability to act or to set up some type of federal regulatory authority on internet gambling, poker in particular. That those, as a rule, stand about as much chance of going anywhere in Congress as anything else does these days, which is to say basically none. But they do have in common that they have generally been drawn up by casino interests. They give strongly preferential treatment to Las Vegas or other big casino operators. And as Mr. Van Petten mentioned, they do grandfather in existing state programs. What will happen there, we don't know, but I don't think any action appears to be imminent. Now, where that's led to in the U.S. is we now have three states who are doing internet poker and other casino games. Nevada is the only one that is active right now. They've been active for 6 months. It is poker only. Right now they have two casinos that are authorized to operate online poker that can only take place within the borders of Nevada. They have not reported any revenues from that. They say they won't report until there's at least a third vendor in operation, so we don't know how well it's doing. But Nevada is very clear that they see this as a growth industry for them and that the operations that are set up in Nevada will then be contracted out to other states who want to get into this. Delaware is actually going live tomorrow. And they are offering a full range of casino games on the internet. It is operated through the Delaware Lottery. But they are doing it under contract with a private concern. New Jersey, again, is offering the full range of casino games in addition to poker, blackjack, slots, roulette, internet craps. And they will begin at the end of November. That is and will be operated through the Atlantic City Casino operations. Basically what you have is the states that are looking at this, you have your choice of three options. The state can provide it themselves, which isn't being done anywhere in the U.S. at the moment, although it's being done in a number of jurisdictions, both in Canada and overseas. They can essentially buy the service from a private operator, as in New Jersey and Delaware, or they can have it be a private enterprise that the state regulates, which is the model in Nevada, also in the United Kingdom. Outside of the U.S., there are more Canadian provinces that have it than don't. Basically, it's Alberta and Saskatchewan are the only ones not offering some form of internet poker. British Columbia developed it and introduced it in 2011. The other provinces are all within the last few months, and they have all contracted with British Columbia to operate their poker systems for them. In Europe, participation is legal in at least 19 European countries. In some cases, the state provides them, as in Sweden and France. And in others, it's under varying degrees of regulation, ranging from very closely regulated in the United Kingdom to essentially not regulated at all. It is not, however, bringing in a tremendous amount of money. The French lottery is dropping their internet poker program because the revenues have simply been too low. British Columbia Has, as mentioned, been operating poker since 2012. Their revenues have been disappointing, as you can see in this quote from their 2012 annual report. They have shown me their revenue figures. They have asked me not to share them. I will tell you that this $8.8 million behind is not a small fraction of what they're expecting. It's a very, very large deviation from expectations, and that their internet poker is a very small percentage of their overall, the overall internet gambling that takes place in that province, which in turn is only about 17% of the total gambling revenue in British Columbia. So if I were to extrapolate the British Columbia numbers to Minnesota, we would be looking at revenues considerably less than $10 million a year. It is not anybody's idea of a financial panacea. A few other issues regarding internet poker security. There are a number of things that have to be done. Verification of the player's identity and where they're located. That's an operation in all kinds of different systems for all sorts of different things. That can be done. And you have to verify age, which generally happens through a link with a bank account. You have to make sure that customers' information is protected. Again, that's no different than all kinds of other things that's doable. You have to make sure that you're operating, that your system does assure valid outcomes, that no one can unfairly game the system. There has to be a very traceable audit trail. Collusion is an interesting issue. That one of the fears on internet gambling is that with poker. Is that if you're playing at a table with four other people, two of them happen to be in the same room and looking at each other's computer screens, they have a considerable advantage. It's fairly easy to stop that simply by randomly assigning people to games, which is something that the overseas sites don't necessarily do. And then there are the bots, basically poker-playing computer programs that can play hundreds of games at a time, and have all kinds of advantages over a player because they're not subject to any kind of emotional decisions. That's an enormous problem with the overseas sites and the large volume sites. The folks in British Columbia have told me that it's not, they don't consider it a problem for them simply because the size of the games, the spending limits make it unprofitable for them, and they, because they're overall platform is relatively small, they can monitor individual play and see and detect any patterns that look like where it looks like the games are actually being played by a computer. But as it, there are a number of concerns. The other issue that is raised frequently is the effect on problem gambling, and there has been a lot of speculation about the potential of poker in particular, but internet gambling in general, to cause an increase in problem gambling simply because of the setting that's involved. There have been a number of studies done on this, primarily in the United Kingdom and Australia. The British study that was done with a large number of gamblers and internet gamblers, the initial conclusion was that there did appear to be a greater risk of gambling problems with internet gamblers. When they studied, they looked at the data a little further, though, what they found was it's pretty very well known that one of the things that you can use to predict whether somebody has a gambling problem is how many different activities they gamble on. It's there's kind of an impression that, well, people who are, have gambling problems have a specialty and that's all they do, and that's not true. People with gambling problems tend to gamble on lots and lots of different things. And when they went back and looked at the British data and controlled for the number of gambling activities, they found that there was nothing really to make internet gambling stand out, that there didn't appear to be any greater risk associated with internet gambling. And in fact, if they looked at people who gambled only on the internet, the number of problem gamblers they found was zero. Australia, which is a very different situation, there was a study that came out within the last month that that indicated that there weren't greater rates of clinically diagnosable gambling disorders. However, there was some indication that people who were gambling on the internet had a higher risk of subclinical problems. The difference is that in the UK, internet gambling is very widespread, but very, very strongly and very well regulated. Australia, at the moment, is all offshore operators and completely unregulated. What you can do on the internet is put in any number of features to make gambling safer. You can put in and enforce spending limits. You can put in and enforce self-exclusion. You can monitor player behavior for indications that somebody is developing a problem and have some different types of intervention figures, none of which you can do in a brick-and-mortar casino environment. And so, I mean, the indication is that those sorts of features, which are present in England, not present in an unregulated situation like Australia, do seem to make a difference. The National Council on Problem Gambling in the U.S. has issued standards for internet gambling. I think we've passed out a set of those. They are, in my viewpoint, standards that are not particularly onerous on a gambling organization, although some of the casinos disagree. And, you know, I can certainly assure you that with anything that is done in Minnesota, we will follow those standards. Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, that's a brief summary of what's going on with internet poker, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Feeney, thank you. And that's actually, for our committee's purposes, that's very extensive and appreciated as we see this continue to emerge. Is there, theoretically, if a Minnesotan wanted to gamble online, you know, get on a device like this, would they be able to do that?
Mr. Chairman, easily.
Okay. How would one go about that, just theoretically?
Just theoretically.
Maybe we probably don't. It's like asking how to make a nuclear bomb. I don't want to know the answer.
Yeah.
So don't say it, but
there's...
But that was my understanding.
Google.
As well.
It's not, yeah, it's not difficult.
And perhaps we've got a couple folks on the list that have questions. I suspect they had the same question, but maybe not. Representative Davidson and Representative Sanders. Representative Davidson.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple quick things. First of all, to either of the witnesses, you go down the Gold Concourse at the airport out here, and there's these gambling machines. Is that lottery, or who is that, and what is that on the Gold Concourse when you go up there?
Gambling machines? Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, there are the lottery vending machines that you, but I think you're talking about the tablet sorts of things.
I think he is too.
Yeah, the electronic pull tabs.
I guess I am.
Electronic pull tabs are available there. I'm not sure how extensive that is, but that's the only thing that you could gamble on electronically at the airport at the moment.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I am. This is very interesting, and I think part of the whole issue is when the lottery, you come to the committee and you tell us what you've done, you don't come to the committee and ask us what you can do. And I think that's what the problem is. It's kind of like it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission type of thing.
You've been doing it for years.
It works. It's effective. but I think that's part of the that's a big part of the problem here, because you come and tell us what you've done, and I don't think you have authority to do a lot of this stuff, but according to this member, you've got authority to do whatever you want to at any time. But my other question is this. You just said that there's zero problem. You know, how do you tell a problem gambler? I figure it's probably about the time that they lost their house, they lost their marriage, they lost their puppies, they've lost all these things. That's kind of a hint of when we've got a problem here, and that happens all the time. So to suggest that there's zero problem for gamblers if we go onto the internet, I think is simply nonsensical, because this is a massive, you're proposing massive, massive expansions of gaming. Massive expansions of gaming. So my question is, what are the social costs that you see? There has to say it's not the internet, it's just all this expanded stuff. What are the social costs? Because we know that the treatment that the state actually loses more money than they gain from lottery issues. We spend more money on social services to take care of problem gamblers than we make. Okay, so it's kind of like if you're losing a dime per hog, you just raise more hogs. I mean, this whole thing makes no sense because it's very costly, the social cost. So if you're going to do all of this tremendous expansion of gaming, are you figuring in your numbers how much it's going to cost the state because now we have more problem gamblers?
And Representative Davids, first off, in fairness to these guys, I'm assuming now that you're referencing the memo that you did earlier, that was the February 2012 memo.
Yes, Mr.
About
Chairman.
Expansion of gaming. The report that Mr. Feeney just did was at my request. I simply wanted to know what other states were doing, because my understanding is that Minnesotans are able to get on and do participate in these internet gaming opportunities, whether we like it or not. So in fairness to Mr. Freeney's presentation, that was at my request to know kind of what's going on in the world. You're back to the memo that they wrote about, or that Mr. McConnell wrote
Well, Mr. Chairman, kind of both. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the lottery is basing their decisions to go forward with a lot of this expansion of gambling from this memo. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
I'll leave that to Mr. Van Petten or Mr. Feeney to answer.
That's
Van Petten.
Partially correct. That memo was written about a month before I got to Minnesota and was reviewed at that time. However, before we went forward, the vendors have independently gotten opinions from either their legal staff or retained counsel that what we were doing was legal and they were safe to go forward. But they did not rely on our counsel. They got their own independent counsel. Those communications, of course, are attorney-client privilege, and I do not have access to them.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Petten. This is basically the document that you're moving forward with, even though you weren't here. I don't think it matters that you weren't here when this was created. This is what you're going by. This is what you're going by. But to my question is, with all the tremendous expansion of gambling that's being proposed here, how are you calculating the social costs?
I'm sorry, what?
With all the tremendous expansion of gambling that you're looking at here, how are you factoring? You know there's going to be social costs. You know there's going to be people in treatment. You know there's going to be suicides. You know there's going to be people losing their homes and their farms. You know that. So with the expansion of gambling you're looking at, I mean, you just said that zero problem with internet gaming. I don't believe that for a second. How do you calculate in the social costs? Because they're there. How are you calculating and accounting for them?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have no intention of going forward with internet gaming. Those were reports prepared at the Chair's request to see what was going on in other jurisdictions. At the interest of transparency, you had mentioned the G Concourse earlier. We are presently in negotiation with the company OTG. They have requested access through their internet connections to sell our products over the internet, and that would be the draw products, the draw games, and electronic instant tickets, but none of the what we would refer to as internet gaming.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, but back to my question. With the massive potential expansion, I mean, you're going to be doing some internet stuff the way it sounds. How are you calculating in social costs? How does lottery calculate social costs for the damage it's doing to people's lives in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Feeney might be better to answer this. However, we work extremely closely. Well, first of all, I'd like to say we don't see that we are instituting any kind of an expansion of gaming. We updated our website September 10 of 2013. We have had subscription sales available since November of 2010, and that's the website that we updated and will continue to operate on. We also work very closely with North Star Alliance, and I really don't see the lottery as causing extensive personal costs. Mr. Feeney can address that further.
Gentlemen, if I could request, my recollection, I'm sure Representative Davids remembers it as well, when you came during the session and provide us an update, there was an entire section on the North Star Alliance and the incidence of problem gaming. If you could, if that's been updated, but perhaps you can send that to all the members of the committee as well. I don't know if you have, I'm guessing you don't have that with you today, but it'd be helpful to have that again. I think that was very informative and helpful.
Mr. Chairman, this is, I should say, by the way, just For background regarding problem gambling, it's an issue that the lottery is very heavily involved in, and myself in particular, I am the immediate past president of the National Council on Problem Gambling. I'm on the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance's Board of Directors, the Department of Human Services Advisory Committee. I've published on the subject. I am a frequent speaker at problem gambling training conferences. It's very hard to give a short, concise, to give an adequate answer to that is going to take a lot more time than I think than you have. But succinctly, if I can, it's the social. There have been many, many attempts to calculate social costs of gambling. None of which have worked particularly well. One of the major problems is that gambling addictions don't exist in a vacuum, that it is extraordinary that something like 70% of people who are diagnosed with a gambling addiction, and there is a very strict clinical definition for that, and a list of criteria that people meet for that diagnosis, so it can be objectively diagnosed. 70% of those folks have a history of chemical dependency. An awful lot of people who are admitted to treatment programs with a chemical dependency issue have a history of a gambling problem. And so there are all kinds of other mental health issues that are intertwined with that as well. So you have the issue of, if there is a social cost, how much of that do you assign to the gambling problem? How much do you assign to a chemical addiction? How much of it do you assign to a previously existing depression, schizophrenia, what have you? So that becomes absolutely impossible to determine. And
Mr. Feeney, if I might, I think you've already demonstrated to us that there's a complexity to the issue, and Representative Davids was nice enough at the beginning of his question to say it was just going to be a real short one. To use this, I think...
Mr. Chairman, I can talk offline with folks. I think we should move on with questioning. I thank you for your indulgence, sir.
Thank you. And we've got Representative Sanders. I want to hear from Mr. Lund, and then we're going to wrap up this part of the discussion. So, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I've looked through this document here from Mr. McDonnell, and that's where I'm basing my questions off of. But going back to your comment really quick, Mr. Van Petten, is it the lottery's intention to offer slot machine type games and roulette and crap type games over the internet through the lottery?
Absolutely not. Representative Sanders?
Absolutely not is the answer. So the state lottery will not be at any time under your leadership offering slot machine type games over the internet or roulette and craps through the lottery.
We have no intention for any type of casino style gaming. Only to sell what products we already have available.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I go back through the document, that's I guess comforting to hear. I think it's a little confusing in the document, because everywhere we see here that, you know, Minnesota law allows this type of game. The lottery assumes it has that authority to run that. And so I would at least hope that you would come to the legislature if you wanted to go down that road. Because throughout all of this document, you know, we've seen some of the federal acts and decisions that have come down. But the one that's most important to me is the Minnesota State Constitution. And even according to this this memo here in 1989, the amendment said that the lottery could authorize a game but sell lottery tickets. It actually has the word ticket in the Constitution.
Yes.
And so if we're going to ever deviate from that, I think it absolutely needs to come through the legislature, in as much as sprinkled all throughout this memo are words like widely assumed, it appears, those sorts of things need to be established through the legislature, decided by the legislature, in my opinion.
Thank you, Representative Sanders.
I made the statement that we only plan to sell products we presently have available, and that is instant tickets. They are not presently available on the Internet, however, will be in the near future. I just don't want that to be misinterpreted as misinformation in this hearing, because instant tickets are available, and we intend to make those available on the Internet.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Lund, would you join us for just a moment or two? And my hope now, you know, I expected to have this portion of our hearing done by about 10 o'clock. It's now 10 o'clock. So, Mr. Lund, if you could do your best not to say anything too inciting, like, you know, that'll set anybody on fire. Insightful is fine. Inciting, not so much. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a very brief statement to read. Charitable gaming in Minnesota views the lottery as a competitor. It is a good thing that both of us had very good fiscal years last year. Our business was up 8%. Charitable gaming operates, for better or worse, in an arena that is highly regulated. Apparently, the lottery does not have the same constraints as we do. We believe that the lottery moving into internet gaming and proposing games such as scratch-offs and spinning wheels to be played on home computers and mobile devices is a significant policy decision that must be made only after significant discussion and debate by the legislature. Internet gaming might very well be the largest expansion of gambling ever in the state of Minnesota. We ask that an open discussion take place at the legislature, and if you decide to grant the lottery or anyone else the authority to engage in internet gaming, we would ask that we be given the same opportunity. What the lottery has done in the last year or so is get their infrastructure ready, where now beside their 3,500 brick and mortar sites, they now have the ability to deliver to every gas pump, every ATM, every cell phone, every computer in the state of Minnesota. We do not believe that it was the intent of the legislature to allow 24/7, 365, anywhere in the state, gaming on devices like this. And all we're asking is that this be, the light be shown on this, and the ability to have an open and honest discussion. Is this where we want our state to go? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Thank you, Mr. Feeney. Thank you, Mr. Van Petten. And thank you, members. You have very articulately in an hour expressed why I opted to hold a hearing on this topic and why I think this is just the beginning of an ongoing conversation. And I value Mr. Van Petten's comments earlier about doing their best to try to enhance the communication, because I do think as we continue forward with gaming ventures, that level of communication is going to be even more necessary than it has been in the past. Next up is a discussion of the interior design licensing. This is generally the discussion of the topic. Representative Hillstrom has the bill. I believe it's House File 1052. I've gotten a number of emails. I'm sure other members have as well. It's an issue, just to give a little bit of background, it's an issue that's been around for some time. I think many members who've been in the legislature for a while have probably heard about the legislation for some time. It is one that we're primarily interested in hearing if there is new evidence, new things going on in the world of interior design, or generally the area of construction and planning that would change the debate or offer anything new that members ought to be aware of. For the sake of everybody, and I haven't counted everybody on here, Representative Hillstrom, but it looks to be 11 or 12 testifiers. What I would request of folks who are testifying, if someone ahead of you has already expressed the point that you wanted to make, then for the sake of the folks after you, please don't feel the need to make that same point yet again. The goal here is to try to get a good picture where things stand. Representative Hillstrom, it's your bill. you're welcome to make as many or as few comments as you'd like to, but certainly it's your proposal, and we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, I first got this bill last year. Paul Thiessen previously carried this proposal before me, so this has been a new issue for me to work on. But we're pleased to be in front of the committee again and to continue to educate members and the public on why interior designers are seeking licensure. Minnesota statutes and rules already allows interior designers to have stamp and certification procedures. However, they don't have licensure. And so this causes a challenge in that the rules are applied differently in different parts of the state. And so I have a number of testifiers here that really would like to talk about the clarification in law that they would like to move from this certification to the licensure. And, Mr. Chair, I'd really like to have them tell you about this proposal.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom.
Chair Atkins, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us back. My name is Rochelle Schessler-Lynn, and I am representing MIDLAC, the Minnesota Interior Design Legislative Action Committee. I am a certified interior designer practicing in Minnesota. I am a senior associate with MSR, an architecture, interiors, and urban planning firm in Minneapolis. Instead of repeating my testimony from last spring, I would like to use this time to explain where we are today in terms of Minnesota's current statutes and rules, and also to clear up any confusion that would actually change of what would actually change and what would not change if this bill becomes law. 21 years ago, the legislature passed and Governor Carlson signed a bill that established certification process for Minnesota for interior designers. Interior designers meeting qualifications set by the state regulatory board can currently apply to become certified interior designer. The state regulatory board is the AELSLAGID board, architecture, engineering, land surveying, landscape architecture, geoscience, and interior design, which regulates the professions of architects, professional engineers, land surveyors, landscape architects, professional geologists, professional soil scientists, and certified interior designers. I served for 8 years as one of the two interior designers that are represented on the licensing board. All of these professions work together in the non-residential, and this is important, built environment. There are varying degrees of overlap between the various professions on this board, which is common in many professions. For example, the Minnesota Health Licensing Boards that include medical practice, nursing, chiropractic, optometry, pharmacy. With the exception of certified interior designers, all of the other professions regulated by the AELSLAGID board are licensed, which means that they have what is called a practice act. Certified interior designers have what is called a title act, which protects the title certified interior designer. Anyone in the state of Minnesota right now, whether or not they have any education or training whatsoever, can call themselves an interior designer. They cannot call themselves a certified interior designer. A practice act protects both the title and the practice of the profession. If you have licensure of a profession, you have a practice act. Current Minnesota law is a little bit different from other states with title acts in that it goes one step further. This is part of the reason why we are here today, as I will further explain in a moment. If this bill passes, anyone will still be able to call themselves an interior designer, but they will not be able to use the title licensed interior designer or practice licensed interior design. They will still be able to practice a wide scope of interior design that does not require licensure. Essentially, for these individuals who are not currently certified or who are not currently qualified to become certified, nothing will change in their ability to practice if this bill becomes law, contrary to what you will likely hear. Now, even though Minnesota does not have licensure of interior designers, we do have a hybrid act under current law. When the legislature passed the law creating certified interior designers back in 1992, they intentionally included language that would give certified interior designers something referred to as stamp and seal privileges. Specifically, current Minnesota statute 326.03 subdivision 1 states, and you have this in your folder, no person except an architect, engineer, land surveyor, landscape architect, geoscientist, or certified interior designer, licensed or certified, shall practice architecture, professional engineering, land surveying, landscape architecture, or professional geoscience, or use the title certified interior designer, respectively, in the preparation of plans, specifications, reports, plats, or other architectural, engineering, land surveying, landscape architectural, geoscientific, or interior design documents. This goes beyond a title act in that certified interior designers can by law stamp and seal construction documents just as the other licensed professionals can and present these drawings to building code officials for approval and permitting. However, despite the language of the statute, as certified interior designers are certified and licensed, which is different from all of the other professions on the state licensing board, this has proved confusing to building code officials. Therefore, some certified interior designers have found themselves in the position where building code officials in certain cities will accept their documents while building code officials in other cities will not. We are here today to ask that the current certification process for interior designers be changed to licensure. All of the other professions on the licensing board have gone through the process of securing licensure as their respective professions have progressed. Nationally, there are 11 states that have interior design title acts. There are 4 states plus Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico that have practice acts. And there are 10 states that have hybrid acts like Minnesota. Interior design is a regulated profession in over half of the United States. The threshold for licensure is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. When the legislature established certification for interior designers and gave certified interior designers stamp and seal privileges 21 years ago, the legislature recognized that this certification was needed in order to establish qualifications for interior designers to sign construction documents to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. I want to explain what the statute covers, as I think this is an area of confusion. If you look again at your handout of the Minnesota statutes 326.03, this time at subdivision 2, it lists what are referred to as exempt spaces. An exempt space means that any citizen can design these spaces. There is no licensed professional of any discipline needed to design these spaces. Please refer to your handout for the specific language. Essentially, it states that there are no restrictions in the design of single-family homes, including individual condo units, two-family dwellings, farm buildings, and specific temporary buildings. Additionally, if you look at Minnesota rules, there are additional exemptions listed for specific classes of buildings. For example, dining and drinking establishments, i.e. restaurants, with seating for not more than 20 persons, and businesses that are not over 2,250 square feet. In addition, specific remodeling and renovation projects in spaces not requiring a design professional signature, and exemptions from building permit requirements for work such as painting, wallpapering, tiling, carpeting, cabinetry, countertops, and similar finish work. If work does not require a building permit, it does not require the signature of a certified interior designer, architect, or other design professional. Not only is it important to keep in mind all of the exemptions for any licensed professional in Minnesota statutes and rules, it is also important to recognize that many interior designers practice exclusively in the area of residential design, which, as I have already noted, as a space that does not require a licensed professional. So to make this a little bit clearer, let's just think about our own life. How many people actually live in a home where the plans were designed by and signed by a licensed architect? Most people live in homes where the plans are designed by the builder, the general contractor, or the housing developer, because homes are not required to be designed by a licensed professional. Similarly, if this bill passes, you would not need a licensed interior designer to design the interior of your home. Where would the law require a licensed interior designer? The exact same spaces that under existing Minnesota statutes and rules that currently require a licensed professional or a certified interior designer to sign documents. Some examples are hospitals, nursing homes, schools, and office buildings. Essentially, if in your profession the scope of work does require the signature of licensed or certified professional in order to obtain a building permit, a licensed certified professional will still need to sign the construction documents if this bill passes. If you are already not required to submit signed documents for construction, you will not need to do so in the future. Nothing in this bill changes what you currently can and cannot do. However, it does ensure that certified interior designers who currently have met the criteria set by the state of Minnesota to sign construction documents will be able to continue to sign these documents as licensed interior designers and remove any confusion with the building code officials. As the profession of interior design has evolved, so have the standards for education, experience, and examination. This is another area of confusion. I want to make it perfectly clear that this standard for education, experience, and examination is set by the State Licensing Board and codified in Minnesota rules. The State Licensing Board went through a rulemaking process back in 2011, which increased the educational requirements for certified interior designers under Minnesota rules 1800.2100, which now requires graduation from a 4 or 5 year professional level interior design program resulting in a bachelor's or master's degree from a CETA accredited program. The completion of an interior design experience program, which is a structured internship program similar to a program required for architects, or a minimum of 2 years of qualifying design experience under the direct supervision of a certified interior designer or licensed architect. The experience that is required must also demonstrate experience in building codes and the preparation of construction documents. They must also pass a written exam, which is administered by the National Council of the Interior Design Qualification. The requirements in Minnesota rules have been in place since 2011. Therefore, anyone entering a two-year program should be aware of this, and this is completely unrelated to our bill. Our bill does not change what is in Minnesota rules, and it pertains to the education, experience, and examination requirements to currently become a certified interior designer or in the future to become a licensed interior designer. I want to be clear that the two-year interior design programs are now and always will be needed. As is true with many degree programs, a two-year degree and a four-year degree provide a different amount of education. Students know this when they enter a program. For example, a student that enters a two-year architectural drafting and design program offered by various institutions in the state of Minnesota knows that this degree will not allow them to apply to the board to become a licensed architect. This does not mean that the degree does not have value, as they can use the degree to become a drafter or a CAD technician or a design assistant. This is similar to the interior design student. Students graduating from a two-year program can still use the title interior designer and they can practice in any residential or design interiors in any residential space or design any interior spaces that do not require the signature of a certified or licensed professional, and they can also work under the direct supervision of a certified interior designer. This bill changes nothing for them. What this bill will change, however, is the ability for current and qualifying certified interior designers to practice to the full extent of their education and training as licensed interior designers. I should also note that the University of Minnesota is not the only school with CETA-accredited interior design program. Dunwoody recently received accreditation from CETA for their four-year interior design degree program, and St. Catherine University launched their four-year interior design program in 2012. The St. Kate's program has been developed according to CETA accreditation, and there is a letter in your folder from one of the professors at St. Kate's. Minnesota has significant numbers of graduates that work here from accredited programs in Kansas, Iowa, Wisconsin, South Dakota, and North Dakota as well. And in addition, many of the most recent interior design graduates are graduating with Masters of Interior Design degrees. The Minnesota chapter of the American Institute of Architects has recently made the claim that interior designers are trying to practice architecture. This is simply untrue. Certified interior design is a separate profession. If you look at the University of Minnesota College of Design, for example, it includes two separate and distinct degree programs, architecture and interior design. If an interior design student wanted to become an architect, they would have entered the program of architecture. Instead, these students choose to enter the program in interior design because this is the field that they wish to practice in. You should also know that currently any architect can apply to become a certified interior designer, and they would be able to apply to become a licensed interior designer if this bill passes. This bill would not keep architects from practicing in the interior space. However, there is a need for licensed interior designers who are trained exclusively in designing interior spaces. I've brought a typical diagrammatic plan and a set of construction documents that also show the level of detail that is required, and you should have these in your folder. If you look at the front page, the orange in the diagram designates what we call the building core and shell, and a typical multi-tenant office building. The core and shell is typically designed by architects and engineers for the developer. If you look at the second page, the gray and the black areas show an example of interior construction and furniture designed for each separate tenant after they sign a lease. These spaces are constructed and remodeled many times over the life of the building. In these types of projects, the base building architecture is essentially separate from the tenant's interior build-out. And this is the scope of practice that is within the certified interior designer's practice currently and would be in future for licensed interior designers. Restaurant, retail, and similar interior renovation projects are completed in a similar way. Certified interior designers are currently qualified, and licensed interior designers would be qualified to work in the gray and black areas and sign construction documents for these areas. Like architects, certified interior designers also do and would work with other professionals, such as engineers, as needed. Please note in the bill language the seven items that are not included in the licensed interior design practice. In essence, these include the load-bearing walls and fire safety elements. This bill also specifically states that licensed interior design is not the practice of architecture, landscape architecture, or engineering. For architects to claim that certified interior designers or licensed interior designers are trying to practice architecture, this implies that they don't recognize certified interior design as a distinct and valuable profession. The truth is that certified interior designers and architects are working together right now on many projects throughout the state. Changing certified interior design to licensed interior design should not be seen as a threat to the architects. It would allow qualified, as determined by current Minnesota rules, interior designers to practice to the full extent of what they have been educated and trained to do. It seems inappropriate that one profession that has achieved licensure would work so hard to stop separate allied professions that they work closely with from having the ability to also be licensed. The protection of the health, safety, and welfare of the public is increased if both professions are licensed, as was evident when the state of Minnesota passed the law to certify interior designers that includes stamp and seal privileges in 1992. I want to note that some of the opposition to our bill is coming from organizations at the national level. For example, the National Kitchen and Bath Association, NKBA. And they may not fully understand what the language in our bill says. Minnesota is unique, and our language is different from language found in other states. Our bill language specifically states that the practice of licensed interior design does not apply to an employer or owner of a retail establishment providing consultation in the furtherance of a retail sale or prospective retail sale regarding interior finishes, furnishings, or cabinetry on behalf of the retail establishment, i.e. Lowe's, Home Depot, Creative Lighting, Premier Restaurant Equipment Company. A person who provides services or assistance in selection, sale, lease, or supply of surface materials, window treatments, wall coverings, paint, floor coverings, surface-mounted fixtures, displays, loose furnishings for the interior of buildings, or a residential designer, including a kitchen or bath designer, working within the interiors of exempt spaces. So a lot of our retailers, such as Hirschfields, as I mentioned, Home Depot, and there's a lot of other interior retailers that would continue to practice and do the business as usual as they have always done. This is on top of the exempt spaces already established in Minnesota statutes and rules that apply to all of the certified licensed professions. Please keep this in mind as you listen to further testimony today and make sure that what is stated actually takes into account the language of the bill in front of you today, House File 1052, along with the existing statutes and rules and Minnesota building codes. If any of the individuals who are writing in opposition or testifying in opposition to the bill are not required to sign plans for permits under current law, they will still be able to continue this service or practice if the bill passes. If they are providing a service or practicing today in violation of current law, it would still be in violation of current law if the bill passes. Nothing changes for them. Thank you for your time and consideration today. We ask for your support. We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you. We would be happy to answer questions that you may have, and I would like to introduce Mr. Bill Hickey.
And thank you. That was very helpful and thoughtful. I do note it, at least in what I had planned for the amount of time, it nearly exhausts the amount of time that's available for the proponents. That said, if I believe we've got two others, Mr. Hickey and Ms. Harlander-Eggerman, to testify in support, and I'd welcome you to do that. I want to give the folks who signed up in opposition an equal amount of time. So we're looking at, for the two of you, about 5-6 minutes yet?
No problem.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, committee members. By way of introduction, I'm Bill Hickey. I am a owner and principal at Collaborative Design Group. We are a multidisciplinary firm. I employ architects, engineers, planners, and like almost every mid to large size architectural firm, interior designers. It is also important, I should note, I'm a licensed architect and also a certified interior designer. That is a relatively unique perspective and lets me really understand the difference between the professions and their complementary nature. Architecture is broad and very wide-ranging. Interior design is deep and more focused and specific, and I think that is a reflection in what you see in practice. Our design professions are collaborative. They're mutually independent, and a responsibility to promote health, safety, and welfare for the citizens of Minnesota is central to all of our tasks. We believe this bill clearly defines the practice of architecture versus interior design versus engineering in company, with the rest of the legislation, Minnesota rules existing already. I do not feel, as an architect, as a business owner, that this is any threat to existing professions, nor do I feel that it redefines any profession. It clarifies the role of interior design, commercial interior design, licensed interior design, in protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of the state, and I really believe it is worthy of your support. With that, I'd just introduce Aaron Edgerman.
Thank you. Ms. Edgerman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Atkins and committee members. I'm Aaron Edgerman, a student at the University of Minnesota in interior design, and I'm originally from the St. Cloud area. I'm also a LEED Green Associate and have completed two prior internships at interior design companies. I want to explain how the decisions I made for my education and now how this legislation can impact my future. I specifically chose a four-year CETA-accredited program because of the opportunities it allows in commercial design. Interior design for me is the perfect combination of people and place, merging behavioral psychology and the built environment to create a positive impact on the lives of people. It is also a constantly evolving profession that presents opportunities for growth and potential new strategies for improving design. I want to design for safety, creating circulation and wayfinding in hospitals that facilitates safe and efficient movement for those in wheelchairs, families with strollers and small children, as well as bariatric and elderly populations. I want to design offices that are ergonomically successful, improving employee wellness, and therefore increasing productivity and company loyalty. I want to design schools to specify interior materials and finishes without volatile organic compounds to create a healthy environment that improves focus and brain development. I want to create durable, multifunctional spaces that employ sustainable strategies to lessen the environmental impact of the built environment. I want to design all of these spaces: healthcare facilities, grocery stores, government buildings, corporate offices, schools, and libraries to protect the health, safety, and welfare of all people by applying the building codes, accessibility standards, and sustainable practices that I have learned over the past 4 years. I would like to think that committee members, and especially allied professionals, would be able to see the benefits and importance of commercial interior design and this bill as a part of the evolution of the field and a continuation of growth and development for the greater good. This bill does not change the futures of students of 2 or 3 year programs, but it directly impacts my goals and my future of practicing interior design to the fullest extent of my education and degree upon graduating in May. Most importantly, it directly impacts the Minnesota public and can ensure that we are creating the best spaces for all people. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. You're a credit to my alma mater. I hope my two sons at the U are getting as good of an education. Maybe you came in that articulate. But, man, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we've got a number of folks, and then I do want to reserve a little bit of time at the end for some questions. I should have noted also at the outset, this is an informational hearing, so we won't be taking a vote on this bill at the end. We may take a vote in the upcoming session, but we tend not to vote on bills during the interim. Next up is Ms. Voda, and then Ms. Hayes-Gordon. And we're roughly going to have an equal amount of time. We do have a few more testifiers in opposition, and I don't want to cut anybody off, but at the same time, to the extent we take a lot of time at the outset, that'll leave a little lesser time for folks at the end. So just try to be Minnesota nice in the length of your comments. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Adkins, members of the committee. My name is Ann Voda. I'm an architect. I live and practice in Minneapolis. I'm also the current president of American Institute of Architects Minnesota chapter component. And Meredith Hayes-Gordon and I are speaking today on behalf of that organization in opposition to the proposed legislation. The current Minnesota law works well to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. There's been no evidence of harm or danger to the public from the activities of certified interior designers. We oppose licensing interior design because it will diminish these protections that are already in place. It will allow licensed interior designers to sign architectural drawings and coordinate the engineers without having the necessary education, experience, or examination required to be an architect. Buildings are not simple. They consist of complicated and interlocking components and systems on the exterior and the interior. Mechanical fresh air, power, lighting, fire sprinklers, exits, corridors, occupant loads, all are designed and coordinated to function together within the building as a whole. Remodeling existing buildings also require this broad understanding of the relationships between building elements and systems. As Rochelle said, with this diagram, it illustrates that this proposal will allow licensed interior designers to move walls and ceilings and floors and coordinate all the life safety features located within and below and beneath them. The activities the interior designers wish to license are already safeguarded by licensed architects and engineers who have the qualifications to do so.
Again, my name is Meredith Hayes Gordon. I'm a licensed architect in the state of Minnesota. Only licensed architects are qualified to orchestrate and coordinate all the complex components and systems that make up a whole building. As a profession, we take licensure and the responsibility of the health, safety, and welfare of the public very seriously. It takes an individual on average 14 years to become a licensed architect in the United States. That's 5 to 7 years of college education, minimum of 3 years of internship, and then 7 exams. And those exams focus on very specific pieces of a building. We have examinations in mechanical systems, electrical systems, structural design. It's important as the architect and facilitator of the whole building to understand all of those pieces that go into it.
So to close, current law already effectively protects the public in the area of interior design. In Minnesota, architects and engineers currently perform all the professional building design services required to effectively safeguard the life, health, and property of the public. Overlapping licenses will add conflicts and confusion, increasing risk to the public. Who's doing what? Who's responsible in a project? Therefore, we oppose this bill as it diminishes protections of the public that currently work well. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We received 2 handouts during the course of your testimony.
Thank you.
This is the one that.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that we connected the dots.
Yeah, the red dot.
Yeah, literally dots. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up on the list, I have Mr. McGrath. And members, you'll find some. I believe Mr. McGrath has provided his testimony. There was also a link that was sent to you prior to today's testimony with a connection to a video. I think that's how I best describe it, Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask, where did this come from?
I was going to ask somebody. There's a blue and black one, and I believe that one is from Mr. Nagorski, who's going to testify shortly.
I just want to know where it came from.
Yeah, and I was going to ask the same question, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you. Mr. McGrath,
Mr. Chairman,
welcome back.
Members of the, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Hillstrom. My name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice, a not-for-profit public interest law firm. I run the Minnesota chapter. I appreciate the committee's giving me the opportunity to testify and to continue the discussion. My firm opposes this legislation. For over 20 years, my firm has lobbied and litigated against occupational licensing laws because we have great skepticism about the efficacy of fencing out workers, and that is inherent in occupational licensing laws. I observe this morning, I'll just summarize one point in the written testimony that I have given you, and if you would like to, I point to the bottom of page 3 of my testimony, because there I ask you to see that the state of Minnesota in its policy also shares that skepticism about occupational licensing. In 1984, it enacted a Sunrise Act, the first in the nation's Minnesota Statute 214.001. And the first sentence of that legislation, of that policy established by your predecessors, is that the legislature declares that no regulation shall be imposed upon any occupation unless required for the safety and well-being of the citizens of the state. You can go on and read the rest of my testimony, Mr. Chairman, but I'll just point to one idea. Who is being protected by this proposed legislation? Well, given all the exemptions that are embedded in this for political reasons, the only people who are being allegedly protected are those who own and operate large construction companies that build restaurants, hospitals, and schools. Well, I submit to you that these people are rather sophisticated. They do not need the help of the legislature to determine the qualities of the subcontractors that they work with. They enjoy today, those contractors, the benefit of knowing that people have passed exams, have been certified, but they don't need the high costs that are inherent in licensing in terms of reducing the supply of available workers to meet their needs. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. McGrath, thank you. I always find your perspective an interesting one to listen to. I also, members, by the way, I pointed out materials in the packet that were for Mr. McGrath. I'd ask you to give equal attention. There are other letters and materials from folks, I believe, at AELS, LAGID, and others in support of the bill as well. Up next on our list, Mr. Nagorski, I believe, is going to go last. So Ms. Morrow and then Ms. Carlson. I also have Ms. Stryker and Ms. Jurgensen and Ms. Brandt. It's quite a lineup this morning. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Patty Morrow, and I'm the president of Interior Design Protection Consulting. We have offices in South Carolina, in California, and New Hampshire, and I do reside in South Carolina. So what am I doing here in Minnesota? Well, because of the time constraints here, six national trade associations have asked me to come and speak on their behalf for their Minnesota members who will be negatively impacted by this bill. They are the Designer Society of America, Food Service Equipment Distributors Association, Food Service Consultants Society International, Manufacturers Agents Association of the Food Service Industry, North American Association of Food Equipment, and Interiors by Decorating Den. Members of the committee, this is about jobs. By now, I'm sure that you've read the long list of interior design services that would be prohibited if this bill were passed unless you were licensed. If enacted, the members of all of these associations would no longer be able to offer these interior design services. Let's just look at the food service equipment industry. These are the people that design the cafeterias in hospitals, schools, nursing homes. They design restaurants, the kitchens, the dining rooms. These are small business owners with very, very specific knowledge and education and their own certification. If you pass this bill, these small business owners will no longer be able to offer these services, and you will wipe out an entire industry. And for what reason? There's no threat to the health, safety, and welfare of the public. There's not a shred of evidence to warrant a conclusion that the unlicensed practice of interior designers jeopardizes the public in any way. There's been no public outcry for this bill. There's been no legislative determinations that indicate that the public is being harmed. It's simply an effort by a special interest group who want to create a monopoly. And who would that monopoly benefit? 710 certified interior designers in the state, but did you know almost half of them are not even interior designers? They're architects. And of the remaining 50%, how many of those actually have the qualifications that they would like everyone else for licensing to have? Well, if you look at other states that have similar laws, you will see that it's between 60 and 80% that were grandfathered at the time the bill was passed. But your state website doesn't indicate that, nor does the state board know that number. So we went to the actual website of the exam that tests in this for this state that you to be qualified for licensing, the NCIDQ exam. They have a box on their website. It's called the Q-Cert. And that's where a consumer can go into that website to find an NCIDQ designer in that state. So I went to that box, and here's what I found. 59 NCIDQ designers on the Q-Cert in this state. The bottom line, members of the committee, in this difficult economy, why would the legislature even consider enacting a new law in which so few would benefit and so many would be harmed? I urge you to stop this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome. You just identify yourself for the record.
Yes.
And then proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carrie Carlson, and I work in Minneapolis at Sawhill Custom Kitchens in Design at International Market Square as a design assistant currently. In 2004, I was a divorced stay-at-home mother of three children, and I had to find something for full-time employment. I happened upon an ad for Century College in White Bear Lake that offered a kitchen and bath design program. I completed the one-year program and internship and started my career working in a variety of showrooms of kitchen and bath products and doing design work on the side. In January of this year, I was in the position of having to find a new full-time job. The income I had been making working full-time in product showrooms was never going to be enough to support myself and the needs of two of my sons that I have to supplement their income due to one having Asperger's syndrome and the other ADD and anxiety issues. I needed to get a job as a designer in order to make money, but there were not many to be found. I had considered looking in other fields of work, but everything I looked at said the same thing, 1 to 3 years experience needed. I knew I was not in the position to start over yet again and continued my search for a design job. 4 months ago, I was contacted by Sawhill. They had a job opening that they thought I would be great at as a design assistant with the guarantee that as I gained knowledge of their business and took the test for AKBD, I would be given the opportunity to do design work, which would then lead to my income being based on commission from my sales. That potential income that I was told of will more than support myself and family members that need me. Currently, I am assisting in the design of the exterior and interior framing shop and a number of either kitchens, baths, family rooms, and entire home makeovers in either single-family homes, condos, lofts, and other multifamily dwellings. You can see that although the word kitchens is in the name of where I work, we do work throughout the entire homes of all kinds, commercial spaces, and recently a boat. Mr. Chairman, if you allow HB 1052 to proceed, I will, at the age of 54, after 8 years that included school and getting my experience in my field of work, have to start over once again to find work to make enough money to support myself and members of my family that depend on me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. next on the list, I have Ms. Berg, Ms. Stryker, Ms. Jurgensen. Maybe if we can come up a couple at a time. Not that you have to testify simultaneously, but it may just... and then I've also got Ms. Brands and Mr. Nagorski.
Jurgensen, next? Or
I've got Mr. Jurgensen. I've got Ms. Berg and Ms. Stryker as well.
Okay.
Or Ms. Berg Stryker. It's kind of blending here together. So.
Okay. That's okay. Mr. Chair and members of this committee, I'm Galen Jurgensen, and I have an interesting story simply because I taught at a technical school in Alexandria, Minnesota.
Mr. Jurgensen, can I interrupt for just a second? They're going to have a hard time. There's lots of folks watching at home, probably tens of thousands. So you want to make sure that you have the microphone.
And okay.
Otherwise, some fellow will run in here and say they can't hear you at home. So
in very nicely designed places.
Let me start again. Yeah. My name is Galen Jurgensen. I'm from Alexandria, Minnesota, and I respectfully want to address you as a committee and as a chair. I did teach for 34 years. At a technical college. But I want to bring you back a little bit to my first start. I had the opportunity to go to a VOTEC, a two-year technical in Alexandria. If I would speed this forward for you right now, I would not be able to do interior design. Even though I've taught it for that many years, I would not qualify. I am a NCIDQ certificate holder, number 11046, took the exam in 93. I'm qualified to work by myself without doing any harm to occupants of that space. In the process, when I did teach, to go back to the time constraint, I want to make one thing perfectly clear. There should always be more than one right way to become an interior designer. A two-year technical is not an inferior degree. In fact, it's very technical from the standpoint of what the students learn. But there's something else. In my education, during the farm closures or the economy downturns, I had a lot of re-entering adults come in. We retooled them. Now, these are young and old, male and females, that we re-engineered. They might have been in nursing. They probably go into the medical. Very perfect union with interior design and their medical background, or somebody in dental. I've had minorities. Financially, I went to a technical college or technical institute, VOTEC, because of the money. Actually, I went tuition-free in the process to learn how to be an interior designer. When I didn't even know what one was, I was taught what, from a very, very professional person. We hear all this about the education contrast between a four-year and a two-year. The NCIDIQ is an exam that we take, and it was noted there was 59 in the state of Minnesota. The idea is that with my education, my teaching, my understanding of codes and building international residential codes, international building codes, international plumbing codes, I have done very well with my two-year degree, and I would feel discriminated against if I could not escalate to a full status interior designer. So there's a lot of roadblocks that are happening that you can avoid, and you can help people in the process of becoming self-sustaining, very talented individuals that would be open to someone who could not afford a four-year degree. The affordability is not just there for just anybody. So there should be always more than one right way to become an interior designer. Thank you to the committee for the audience. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Jurgensen. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Atkins, and I appreciate the committee taking the time today. My name is Lynn Stryker. I've been an owner of a design firm called Spaces Into Places in St. Paul for the last 10 years. I am a University of Minnesota four-year graduate of their interior design degree program, and I'm here opposing this legislation. I work with a number of aging-in-place clients who are in condo buildings in Lofts downtown. I design church kitchens. I've had showroom designs that I've had to do for a number of clients. Those would all have been prohibited from me participating and practicing my profession based on this legislation that's proposed. I want to tell you that, you know, 59 designers does not a good economy make. Elderly people that are aging in their homes are often on limited incomes. I don't want us to be penalizing people that want to make their environments safer, more comfortable, ergonomic for themselves, with a very short list of people who won't be able to get to all of the need that's out there. It's too wide an environment for all of us to restrict and limit it to such a degree. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
And we appreciate yours. Thank you. I also have Ms. Berg, Ms. Brands, set to testify, and then Mr. Nagorski. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman and committee members, for letting me talk today. I'm Caitlin Brands. I am a second-year student at Alexandria Technical and Community College. We will be graduating this upcoming May, and we will have to be looking towards internships, and then hopefully those will lead into jobs. So you've heard my story back at the last hearing. I also spoke, so I won't reiterate all of that, but you may hear it, so please be patient if you do hear it again. For my program, this year we have three students total that transferred from a CETA-accredited four-year program. We also have half of those three. Then there's half of our enrollment transferred from four-year colleges. So we are thinking that Alex Tech or any two-year program is just as good as a four-year program. We're thinking of quality, not just quantity. As our two-year program for interior design, we cover the same codes, the same material that you would in a four-year college in less time. Then turning and looking at internships. It has been said that there are 59 certified interior designers that have taken the NCIDIQ and passed all examination that qualify. If there are only 2 four-year programs, one graduates 25 students a year, and we can hypothetically say that St. Kate's will graduate 20, that's 49 of the 59 certified interior designers that can have an internship. That does not leave a lot of room for interior designers to study from out of state, and also the next year, how are they going to find an internship for all of those students as well, if you have to do a two-year internship. So I'd like to make that pretty clear. Let's see. It goes saying that four-year colleges concentrate on commercial design. As I've said, I'm taking a two-year program, and I am concentrating on commercial design. We learn the same international building codes as you would in a four-year program, just in less time. That's the big difference between a four-year and a two-year. I still want to design schools, government buildings, hospitals, senior living facilities. That's what I want to design. That's my dream. And I figured out that was my dream in Alexandria at that two-year program, even though I had transferred from a four-year program, which I took a year of. So thinking of how this bill is going to affect people, it will help those 59. How many does that leave out that it will negatively affect in the upcoming years? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brand. Ms. Burke?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time, board. My name is Jacqueline Berg. I consider myself an interior designer. I have graduated from a four-year college from Mankato State University and was given an opportunity through working my way up to work as a project manager for Wells Fargo, doing commercial design, building out spaces for buildings that they operate, whether it's production facilities, office spaces, and alike. In 2008, when the economy went downward and fast, my time with Wells Fargo was not enough to keep me. My 3 years in with them after graduating in 2005 was not enough to hold my position, and I was laid off due to economy reasons. Since then, I have worked hard in my area to continue to stay in the interior design degree and that field. I feel that it is very valuable and that the codes and guidelines that already set and everything that I follow in that project management role as a commercial designer and project manager overseeing jobs, whether it was offices, production facilities, and so forth, stood the test of time. I always had what I needed to do through my education and architects and so forth and alike that already had that certification and helped me oversee projects. So I'd just like to stress to you today that that certification and alike, it's already there. Like it's been said already, there's no public outcry. There's no people saying that there is injustice going on throughout the practice. So I appreciate your time, Mr. Chair.
Well, and the committee's time, and thank you very much.
Yes, committee's time as well. Thank you.
And finally, Mr. Nagorski. Now, this better be good, because we heard you were up higher on the list, but you wanted to have that rousing finish. So
no pressure at all, Mr. Chair.
So the bar is high, Mr. Nagorski. Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Actually, the reason I wanted to go last is because I didn't know if you'd have enough time for me at all. I wanted you to hear from people that are in Minnesota.
Well, in that case, we're out of time. Thank you for coming. I have a question. Sorry, go ahead.
As I said, my name is Ed Nagorski. I'm the legislative director for the National Kitchen and Bath Association and our 1,120 members here in the state of Minnesota. Let me first say that despite the testimony, even though I'm not from Minnesota, I can assure you I have read the bill and do understand what it says. And it does impact our members and many thousands of other related trades that aren't even members of our organization. In the interest of time, I'll cut my remarks extremely short and just really make two points. Well, the question really before the committee is not what work the interior design lobby has allowed the rest of the interior designers to do that you've heard earlier today. It ignores a fundamental question. The question is whether the failure to license interior designers clearly, directly, and significantly affects the public health, safety, and welfare. And as you've heard other testimony today, there is absolutely no evidence of that. In fact, 13 state agencies have already looked at this issue in response to requests by the Interior Design Lobby, supported by the American Society of Interior Designers out of Washington, their professional trade association. They've all looked at this issue and done research and contacted states that have regulations and those that don't. And every single one of those has determined that there is absolutely no reason to license the profession,
Doing so would add not one iota of additional protection to the public beyond what is already in place. And what is already in place is a panoply of professions that oversee design services in the commercial field. You've got architects, engineers, project managers, construction code enforcement officials, building codes, CO requirements, all work together and collaborate as a group in ensuring that public health, safety, and welfare in a commercial setting is already covered. So adding an additional license will add no additional protection to the public. And finally, I'd like to say, as you've heard from a lot of different groups today, both for and against the bill, for and against licensing, but there is one group that you haven't heard from. You haven't heard from the public. The public isn't here saying, please protect us from all these unlicensed interior designers. The Attorney General's office isn't here. The board isn't here saying we've had a rash of complaints against interior designers over the last few years. In fact, in the last number of years, there have been 4 complaints against interior designers and no enforcement actions. Actually, those complaints were going back to 2006. There's been nothing in the records of complaints against interior designers, and certainly in the last 4 years, no actions taken against interior designers. The only ones that are here seeking protection are the small group of interior designers saying, we need to be protected from our competition. We're happy to submit our plans on the merits of our skill and expertise, on our design ability, on our client references, on our portfolios, and let the public decide which interior designer best meets their budget, best meets their vision for their project and what they're looking for, and the designer that works well with them. Design is not a mechanical process. I've joked in the past that I could go to an interior design school and maybe I can learn the mechanics of design. I can never be a designer. A good part of being a designer is a compatibility with the client and understanding and being able to work with them in that respect. It's not what the designer necessarily wants. It's being able to take the vision of the client and translating that into a good design. Let the public, let the consumer decide which designer can actually translate their vision into their space. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nagorski. And Representative Pilstrom, you've sat there politely while folks have kind of stomped on your bill a little bit. Would you like to share a couple of comments? And we'll open it up for some questions as well. But it was a very extensive bit of testimony. Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where to start? Well, let me start by saying that the 59 number that folks are talking about, that this would impact 59 individuals, is not an accurate number, because the only people who get to be part of that search are people who passed the test and paid a fee to be part of that search. So the real number is closer to about 700, just so we start with that piece of information. The second piece that I want to make real clear is that in 1992, the legislature already passed enabling legislation allowing there to be a difference between certified interior designers and not certified interior designers. We are doing nothing to the non-certified interior designers. We're talking about this group that currently are certified saying we're getting unequal treatment as applied. You can go some places and you get your documents approved. You go other places and they say no, you have to have an architect sign off it. While the law since 1992 has said that they have the ability to stamp and seal these documents. So we're not asking for an expanded protection. We're just asking for recognition of the services, to being able to provide the service that they've had the legal right to do since 1992. So why license? Well, if you look at the sheet that the folks that are proposing this put forward, they are the only group that aren't licensed in this entire area that are covered under the AESLAGID, Professional and Related Fields Board. So Mr. Chair, I don't think it's unreasonable for this group to say, we already have these abilities under the law, and we think it should be a license because that's what it rightfully should be based on this quasi group of rights that we already have. Mr. Chair, I just want to also make it really clear, by passing the bill, you're not restricting kitchens and bath designers, restaurant equipment companies, residential interior designers, cabinet shopping, lighting retailers, appliance stores, or anyone else from doing what they're already doing as long as they're already complying with the law. This is just recognizing the distinction that we've made in Minnesota since 1992 and making it a full license, which it should rightfully be. Nothing further, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And if nothing else, you've succeeded. I can now indicate it's AELS, LAGID is the organization. We do have a couple minutes. I kind of wanted to move to the next topic at 11 o'clock, but I think there's a couple minutes. I know Representative Hoppe had a question. He indicated earlier he is an interior designer, I believe, so I expect this
Mr.
to be
Chair,
a very
irritating certified
question.
Or?
I'm a fast disaster.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah, I have been certified.
Representative Hoppe.
Was that out loud?
Yeah.
Yet again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, and I'll go back to the first testifier in favor of this, Ms. Schessler Lynn. A lot of testimony, a lot of things covered. And again, I'm not an architect and I'm not an interior designer. I just don't see a compelling need for this legislation. I don't think there's anything here that we really need to change. And I'll forego most of my questions here, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time. But Ms. Schessler Lynn, you said words to the effect that the proponents don't feel this bill is a threat. Well, clearly there are a lot of people that do feel that it's a threat, and I think it, at best, it needs to be more carefully vetted. And I was sitting here trying to, I just don't see the need for this at this time. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, briefly, because we've got a couple others on the list too.
Thank you, Representative Hoppe. I just want to say that sometimes when there are media releases that go out, I've gotten a whole bunch of contacts from folks that haven't necessarily understood the proposal. That's one of the reasons to have the hearing here today, is so that all sides can have that. And one of the things, one of the reasons why this profession really is seeking licensure is because they are having unequal application of current law, and they believe that with the licensing of the profession, they will get more equal treatment under the law.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Quick question. I know the answer to it, but how many states currently require licensure for interior design?
Representative Hillstrom, if you know, or if you want to phone a friend.
I'm
Representative
phone
Dean said he already knows the answer, so I don't. But it's like being on Jeopardy. The asker of the question knows
so
the.
So four states, including Washington D.C. And Washington D.C. and Puerto Rico.
Thank you, Representative Hill. Representative.
Okay, and Florida is one of those, if I'm correct.
Florida.
Just for the record, for folks to know, Florida, when it comes to professional licensure, is one of the most restrictive states in the country, and partially because they don't want people from other states retiring down to their state to practice their profession. For instance, in the field of architecture, you actually have to bring your transcripts from architecture school if you're going to apply for a license in Florida when you've been licensed in other states. So I just want to, for the record, that this doesn't seem to be something that's a trend in the country currently right now, and it's not that we shouldn't be in front of it if it's the right thing to do, but I think it's something we need to take into consideration.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Anderson? You didn't come with the facial hair today, though. Like, the, you know, we're only... Even Representative Dean, I noted, has the little thing going, but maybe next time, next meeting, you
can... If we did, I'd have some huge problems to address, so...
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, just two quick things. Mr. McGrath, in his sheet that he had here, I think raised a good point. I don't know if you've gone through the process of actually trying to determine if there is a need for this under the statutes of Minnesota that we have under 214, because as it sounds like from the testimony that we've received here today, there hasn't been any harm done to the citizens of the state. So if you could at some point have that done, because I'm not sure if you've done that, it'd just be helpful for me to know, because I think the four criteria laid out in 214, they're in place for a reason, to make sure that if we're going to license an occupation, that you actually have a real reason for doing it. And so far, I'm not convinced of that. So if you guys have not done that portion, I think that it would be helpful for us. The other thing, too, and I don't know if this is for you, Representative Hillstrom, or if it's more for the chair, I just want to make sure that this isn't a precursor to perhaps unionizing these small business owners or not. If you can just kind of give me some clarification that this is not the next step to unionize these small business owners.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This proposal is already recognized under law as having a special designation and has been since 1992. So the legislature already recognized that this group these certified interior designers had a special need to ensure health, welfare, and public safety. So in my opinion, that analysis was done in 1992. They just called it a certification instead of a licensure back then. And so I just think that this is changing the title, which I think is really important, but I can look further at all of those criteria. And I believe that many of these folks, based on where they already work, can be working for a unionized firm or not. And so there's nothing in this proposal dealing with that issue.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Thank you to the folks who came and testified. And thank you, members, for your questions. You always say it's a short question, then it goes on for 20 minutes. But Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the author very quickly. It looks to me like we want to bring a whole bunch of these folks in, and they would have to do continuing education. Is that correct?
How many hours?
Representative Hillstrom.
I say I keep it short, Mr. Chairman. I think Mr. Pender helped me out here. It'd be 24 hours that they would have to sit in classes and totally waste their time. And that's 24 hours of their life that they can never get back, Mr. Chairman.
You know,
I won't be responsible for that.
Representative Davids, you and I may disagree on some certain things, but wasting our time at continuing education and continuing legal education, in my instance, I completely agree with you. I think the legislative time here qualifies as a CLE, though, or as a continuing ed. I'm pretty sure.
There's going to be a bipartisan bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just do some clarification. Everybody else already has to do continuing legal education, and certified interior designers already have to do continuing education as well.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom. So they're already forced to waste 24 hours every 2 years.
You're not going to, he's like a bulldog on that. You're not going to get him off that bone. So
this is an awful.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, and thank you to everybody that joined us today. Next up is a discussion of Stoley and life insurance secondary markets. As folks are empty in the room, I'll give a little bit of Ms. Rowan and her testifiers could join us. For members, I think we had many of you here at the last time. We heard primarily from the folks on the other side of this issue. Hey, folks, shut up, will you? We're having a meeting here. If you can, that was for the thousands of people watching at home. That just try to keep it quiet as you exit the room. And thanks again for coming. Just for background on this Stoley / life insurance secondary or tertiary market issue, we heard predominantly last time from representatives of Fortress and proponents of the bill. This time we're going to hear primarily from the insurance industry folks represented by Ms. Rowan. Just so it's clear, I want to kind of like the foreshadowing I did with the lottery. Insofar as we're hearing this bill, I have zero intention of undoing the protections that we put in place on a bipartisan basis a couple of years ago with respect to stranger-originated life insurance and the ill effects of that. The only interest here would be if there is a surgical way to address the issue that's been raised by the proponents of the bill. I don't know if that's the case or not. I hope that we can hear about the bill and some possibilities from folks here to testify, and then ideally leave a little bit of time for members' questions if they have any. With that, Ms. Rowan, welcome back to the committee. It's nice to see you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. And you notice how the room clears out when we start talking about life insurance, not taking it personally.
Well, most folks are watching on TV at home. We're going. It's nationally being broadcast because we knew it's on pay-per-view as far as I know.
It's ticking up right now as we start this, I'm sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MIFSI. MIFSI is a trade association that represents life insurance and financial service companies here in Minnesota. We have 65,000 jobs in this state, including the agents who distribute our products all over the state. In my more years than I care to mention lobbying this legislature on complex issues, this is a very, very complex issue. How Stoley fraud is perpetrated and what happens to those policies then on the secondary and the tertiary markets is incredibly complex, and I have some very smart folks here with me today that are going to help talk about our views on it. I just want to take a couple minutes to frame the issue and talk about what this is not about, in our opinion. First and foremost,
foremost, this is not about your grandmother's or your neighbor's or your cousin's life insurance policy. Life insurers in Minnesota paid 99.9% of claims in 2012. What this is about is a very sophisticated investor that purchased a book of suspect and likely stolen policies for pennies on the premium dollar. To give you an idea of the size of the policies that we're actually talking about, the book of policies that's received the most attention has a combined death benefit of $6.2 billion, and it's comprised of 980 policies. So if you do the math, which I generally don't like to do, that's about an average size of $6 million a policy. The average size of a life insurance policy in Minnesota, on the other hand, is $147,000. So this is not about your neighbor's life insurance policy. It's also not about the legitimate life settlement market. If you have a policy that you no longer need and want to sell it, the market for that is healthier than it's been in years, and Pam will help talk more about that. Again, what we're talking about is very sophisticated investors who specialize in purchasing distressed assets, looking to the legislature, not just here but in other states as well, to take the risk out of a risky investment that's not panning out. In the 3 years of this debate, no other state has taken them up on this. Specifically, they are seeking to get all the premiums back from the purchase of a stolen or fraudulent policy if a court finds it to be invalid, or they're seeking to limit insurers' ability to challenge stolen policies in court. These measures, in our opinion, unintentionally, of course, would restore the value to fraudulent stolen policies by removing a financial disincentive in purchasing these policies. We think that's a bad idea. Eroding these protections will have a negative impact of exposing seniors to insurance fraud, and will make the cost of life insurance increase for those who want to purchase it to protect their families.
Thank you, Ms. Rowan. And Pam, how do you pronounce your last name?
My last name is pronounced Bunchy. Think a bunch of grapes.
Yeah, I would have.
Bunchy.
And I'm so glad I asked, because I would have screwed that up. But
not Bunchy, a problem.
Welcome,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pamela Bunchy, and I work at Valmark Securities in Akron, Ohio, as the Director of Insurance Services. I'm an attorney, don't hold that against me, a CFP, and I've been in the financial services industry for over 30 years. And as part of my job at Valmark, I run the life settlement division. Valmark is a 50-year-old distribution company with $45 billion of real insurance in place for real people and families with real needs. We have 110 employees with an office in Akron, Ohio, but also an office in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where about a third of our staff is located. As a life settlement broker, we're licensed in most of the regulated states, including Minnesota. We started our life settlement operation in 2004, and since that time, we've reviewed over 3,000 policies and sold 350 policies. I'm here today to tell you that the life settlement market has figured out how to spot stolen policies, and I believe this legislation will hurt the secondary market, not help it. And for the first time in 4 years, the market is back. Please don't change the momentum that we have right now. So there's 3 points that I want to kind of hit on regarding this legislation. First off, it is easy to distinguish stolen policies from legitimate season policies. If I look at the policies that Valmark has sold over the last 9 or 10 years, you'll find, A, there are absolutely no stolen policies. When reviewing policies to determine the eligibility for the secondary market, the best analogy that I can give, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. Legitimate season policies are difficult to find, as you could see from our statistics at Valmark, and I think that they'd be consistent with all brokers. We sell just a little over 10% of the policies that actually come to our office to be evaluated. But when you look at our policies, there's no particular concentration of in terms of policies based on the insured's age, the carriers, the death benefits, the age of the policy, the buying community, or the state of ownership. So what does that mean? One area that distinguishes season policies from stolen policies is the age of the policy when it's sold. The average age of the policies that Valmark sold, and that is from the date it was issued to the date that it sold on the secondary market, is 9 to 10 years old. These policies that we're selling were originally sold for traditional needs, income replacement, business buy-sells, estate planning. And it, basically what happened, these needs changed over time, thereby prompting the sale of the policy. If you look at the portfolio from a hedge fund that is likely to contain what we refer to as STOLI policies, you're likely to see policies that when originally sold in the secondary market were 2 to 3 years old, and the second factor, their premium financed. And many of these policies were originally taken out with the clear intention of selling them after they were issued to someone without insurable interest. At Valmark, we have never in our 9 or 10 years in this business sold a policy that is premium financed. And there's other statistics as well that are important, I think. At Valmark, we've sold our policies through 19 different buyers over the 10 years. There's never been a concentration of buyers. There's not a concentration in a particular state. When I started looking at our statistics, going back to 2008, for instance, you know, we sold 21 policies. That doesn't seem like a lot, but they were from 9 different states. 2009, we sold policies in 11 different states. And if there's a concentration, maybe a few more in Ohio, because that's where a lot of our advisors are located, frankly. Policies that are STOLI, owned by many of the hedge funds, tend to be clustered in states like Minnesota or South Dakota that are favorable to STOLI transactions, or that were favorable. And lastly, the carriers of the policies that we have sold represent probably most all the carriers that Valmark has represented on the life side: Lincoln, Hancock, Minnesota Life, Prudential, Transamerica. There is no concentration with any one carrier. So why is it easy to distinguish STOLI from legitimate policies? Well, if you compare our legitimate life settlement sales with those of hedge funds and other buyers of distressed portfolios, you'll find that their policies look more like the needle factory, not the needle in the haystack. The other thing is, our market today is probably more robust than it's been in 4 or 5 years. So why is it robust and how is it robust? Well, interestingly, most of the so-called STOLI policies were sold into the secondary market probably from about 2005 to 2009. After that period of time, most states have adopted some form of regulation of the life settlement secondary market, including Minnesota, and they've either adopted the NCOIL version or the NAIC version, which basically means there's a 2 to 5 year waiting period before you can sell your policy. And one result of this regulation is that there's now full transparency in this transaction, consumers are protected, brokers and providers are properly regulated and licensed, and there is legitimacy to this transaction right now. Providers and buyers of policies today now do an incredible in-depth due diligence of policies. So frankly, they're not buying STOLI policies. They know it. And their portfolios are filled with clean, seasoned policies. So what this means is that when we're selling a policy through a provider, they're buying a trust-owned policy in particular, they ask a lot of detailed questions regarding the trustees and the beneficiaries of the policy. If there's been any changes to the trustee since the date the policy was originally issued, they're going to ask for more detailed explanation. They're going to ask for documentation regarding all the changes that occurred, if there's any changes of ownership. And more importantly, they also ask, if it's a larger face policy, they ask for the net worth. When we're selling the policy, they're asking for the net worth of the insured now. We have to verify that that insured was worth $10 or $20 million to justify the issuance of the original coverage. Many also, so there's very little possibility right now that the insurer will challenge the payment of the death proceeds, or frankly, that they'll challenge the validity of the policy prior to death in order to have it declared void. The bottom line, we don't feel there's any need for this legislation at hand right now. Another reason is that if you look at during the heyday, as I like to call it, of STOLI, it was possible to buy a policy and then sell it within 2 years and still obtain a value in excess of the premiums paid or the cash surrender value. And this was really due to the fact that the life expectancies for life settlement purposes were aligned with life expectancies for issuing the insurance policy. Well, that's not the case anymore. Since 2008, most all of the life expectancy providers, as we call them, who issue these independent third-party life expectancies, they've changed their tables 2, 3, 4 times, increasing their life expectancies on average 40 to 50%. So frankly, it is almost impossible to buy a policy and then try to sell it within 2 or 3 years unless you've had a very significant change in health. In today's market, the policies being sold are legitimate, and the economics make sense for everybody involved. So how's the market robust? Well, being in this business, today's market, for the first time in 4 years, it's a seller's market. What we've been seeing in the secondary market is a return of institutional money to buy legitimate policies. In fact, the buyers that I work with tell me there isn't a good supply of policies. The result is that policies that have the potential for sale are good policies. Those are the needles found in the haystacks. And they're getting multiple bids with a very robust auction process. And this translates into the value for the consumers are increasing. Our sellers, on average, are getting 20 to 25% of face and 4 to 8 times the surrender value of the policies. And this is probably for the first time in 3 or 4 years. And lastly, I kind of want to repeat one thing that Robin said, is that these aren't your grandmother's policies or your neighbor's policies that are being sold. The average size of the death benefit sold by Valmark as a broker since 2004 is $2.4 million in face. They aren't the policies of the average unsophisticated consumer. The industry has matured. It's no longer the Wild West. There's validity to the life expectancies being calculated by the third-party companies. They're well vetted, the policies at sale. And we have regulation in 44 states that protect the consumers. And for the first time in 4 years, Valmark is seeing increased activity, an active buying community, better returns for our customers on the sale price of their policies, and bottom line, a return of profitability to this business line. Please don't reverse this trend. And I'd like to make one other point. We believe this legislation will encourage sale by agents of questionable policies, those where there's no insurable interest or where they've been fraudulently procured, knowing that even if they're declared void, the investors are going to get a guaranteed return on their investment. They're either going to get a return of the premiums or they're going to get the death benefit. And this legislation, we believe, will cause harm to the secondary market. Three things have occurred over the last 4 or 5 years that we think have stabilized. And I don't mean to be repetition, but I want to emphasize this. The LE companies in 2000-2009 increased their LEs. And what happened was all the institutional money started getting pulled back and contracting. They didn't feel that this secondary business line was secure. In 2008, of course, we all remember the economic downturn in the financial services industry. Again, that added to the contraction of the money and the withdrawal of institutional funds. And then, of course, we had the Stolle litigation that was rampant in 2008 and 2009. We believe that the market literally vanished and is back on track. And Valmark's business mirrored this as well. If I look at where we were 3 years ago, where we are today. So if this bill is passed, insurers and providers in the settlement market will respond by making it harder to underwrite and process both the insurance at the front end and the seasoned settlement for the legitimate clients at the back end. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bunchy. I also have on the list Mr. Wispenhagen and Mr. Flink. Just in terms of equal time, we've now reached the same amount of time that the proponents had at the last hearing. So I'm
working off the assumption, Ms. Rowan, that Mr. Wüstenhagen and Mr. Flink are probably relatively brief in their comments. Is that
correct?
I hope that's fair. Mr. Wüstenhagen, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Wüstenhagen. I am a senior counsel with Securian Financial Group, a financial services company that employs 3,000 associates in downtown St. Paul. I provide legal services to our individual life insurance manufacturer. I'm here today to discuss the concerns life insurance companies have with transactions that result in disguised transfers of life insurance policies. First, I'd like to say that Securian does not oppose the legitimate transfer of policies that no longer meet the needs of the original owner. As Ms. Bunche just explained, there's a legitimate need for those transactions, and we do not oppose them. Life insurance companies are concerned, however, with arrangements that are designed to put life insurance policies in the hands of investors that lack an insurable interest in the life of the insured. These are commonly referred to as stranger-originated life insurance, or STOLI transactions. One method of facilitating STOLI arrangements is through the use of insurance trusts. It's a common practice in the industry for planners to advise individuals to purchase their life insurance policies through insurance trusts in order to maximize liquidity and minimize estate tax liability. In this trust structure, the trust owns a policy and is authorized to pay the policy death benefits to the beneficiaries who are named by the insured. I have brought a diagram today which shows this transaction. Have the members of the committee seen the diagram?
I don't believe we have.
Okay. It's available if you would like to see it. Life insurance companies are familiar with this type of trust, and we have very few concerns with their use. We do have concerns, however, when irrevocable trusts are set up for the purpose of disguising transactions between the beneficiaries and unrelated third-party purchasers. We believe these trusts are used in a way to easily hide evidence of fraudulent activity, which is very difficult and expensive for insurance carriers to detect or investigate. Unlike legitimate transactions where policies are transferred to a trust for the benefit of the insured's named beneficiaries, a disguised transfer is orchestrated by a third-party purchaser or promoter, usually an investor looking to encourage an individual into making false representations on an insurance application to procure the life insurance policy. The third party orchestrates the transfer of the policy into a trust which they ultimately control and allows them to obtain the rights to the death benefit. These are illegal transactions which violate Minnesota insurable interest law. Since the life insurance company, like ours in St. Paul, is usually not involved in the creation of the customer's trust, transfers of beneficial interest in the trust are difficult for us to detect. Insurance applications cannot be designed to fully uncover these kinds of intended transfers, and we do not see or get notice that a beneficiary of the trust has sold their interest to a third party. Consequently, there is nothing that triggers our investigations of beneficial interest transfers. These misrepresentations and disguised transfers negatively impact the underwriting and risk assessment employed by life insurance companies. If the applicants and the third-party promoters of the disguised transactions are allowed to profit from their misrepresentations, the life insurance company and all of its policy owners are impacted. The impact is felt through higher costs, longer and more inefficient underwriting periods, and ultimately, reductions in the availability of insurance products. As a life insurance company, we would oppose any legislation that allows those who intentionally mislead the insurance company or engage in disguised transactions to profit from their actions. Whether it is the applicant that misled, the promoter who advised the applicant, or the third-party purchaser who does not conduct sufficient due diligence when purchasing the policy, legislation that allows them to profit from such transactions disrupts the pooling of risk concept that allows life insurance companies to continue to operate. Furthermore, legislation that accelerates validity disputes will lead to increased litigation prior to the time when the claims for benefits have naturally matured. Life insurance companies have and are continuing to refine their applications to combat the actions of promoters and applicants engaging in STOLI transactions. As Ms. Bunche also mentioned, the secondary market purchasers of life insurance policies are similarly engaging in increased due diligence to ensure the policies they purchased were obtained legitimately. We do not believe that those who engage in disguised or illicit transactions, nor those who purchase policies from them without adequate due diligence, should be allowed to profit from their actions. Consequently, creating new rights and restoring value for third-party institutional investors who have purchased huge portfolios of policies that were issued in stolen transactions provides a continuing incentive to engage in life insurance fraud in contravention of current Minnesota state law. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Westenhagen. And finally, I have Mr. Flink.
Well, I will be very brief, and I do have the prerequisite facial hair, so we can
move right along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Doug Flink. I run a general agency over on the other side of the river that started here in St. Paul 153 years ago in 1860. We have about 150 agents and support staff that are primarily here in Minnesota. I'm here today to represent our professional association, NAFA Minnesota. NAFA Minnesota is the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and we are the Minnesota chapter. I'm a past president and continue to serve on the education and ethics committees on the state level. We have 1,400 members in Minnesota and about 45,000 members nationally. As agents, we place our highest values on integrity and ethical behavior. Our entire existence relies on a high level of public trust. We are against any fraud in any form, and those in our industry that would commit fraud. We feel that any attempt to weaken the provisions of the STOLE laws that we all sat and put together a few years ago would open new doors to fraud in our industry. We don't want new laws that excuse prior bad behavior by providing a pathway to legitimacy and profits from policies that are tainted by STOLE activities. The agents I represent seek to operate in an environment that promotes ethical behavior and discourages fraud. Please do not create additional loopholes to continue the STOLE scourge on my business. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Flink. And then finally on list, I have Mr. Carlson on behalf of Fortress Investment Group. And in this pay-per-view prize fight that we have going, you've got just under 5 minutes if we're going to have equal time between last hearing and this hearing, Mr. Carlson. Hopefully you can. And then, obviously, members will open it to questions. If members have questions or concerns, that's not going to count against anybody's time. I just wanted to make sure that we treated each side fairly. Mr. Carlson, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of Fortress Investment, and I appreciate both the opportunity that the committee has given us to talk about this issue, but I also appreciate the willingness of the insurance industry to sit down with us and a number of you on the committee to talk about what we can do with the problems that we face with a number of insurance policies. And let me say that I don't disagree with much of the testimony that you've heard so far. We do not want fraud in this market. We do not want to have STOLE policies. Investors do not want. We do not want fraud in this market. We do not want to have STOLE policies. Investors do not want to buy them. Minnesota has one of the most restrictive laws in the nation to prevent stranger-originated life insurance, something I participated in 2007 and 2008, and that was to detect and prevent fraud. But I want to be clear on this point. Fraud at the inception of a policy has nothing to do with my client and the people I represent. That fraud at the inception of the policy that they're talking about has nothing to do with the issue that we're trying to bring to the legislature today. And the issue that we're asking you to review is what's lacking in Minnesota. What rights and remedies do valid policyholders have when there is a change of policy or when a benefit is payable? That is the issue that we're bringing to the legislature. You know, we believe that systematic denials of policies that are owned by investors is bad for the secondary market, and that we lack a clear law in Minnesota on how to address this problem. And just so you know the type of policies that we're talking about and want you to focus on, the policies that we're talking about where we believe there are wrongful denials have long passed the 2-year contestability period in Minnesota. They have passed the 4-year period in Minnesota, the limitation on a sale of a life insurance policy. And, you know, the policies that we have that are in question do not have a benefit that is yet payable. So the person who took out the policy, who signed that form, is still alive and can still answer questions about what they wanted the insurance for, and that is key to the remedies that we're asking you to consider. And as we've talked with insurers, and I'm going to just briefly talk about four potential solutions that we'd like you to look at, and I know some of them are more poison pills to the insurers than others.
And you're going to do it at 90 seconds or less.
That's
right?
All right. I'm going quick, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, first of all, we think you can clarify the existing STOLI law. Right now, you have to provide an affidavit or a statement when you sell your policy within 4 years. We think that you could remove that four-year period. Make that statement and make that time at the change, any time the change is being made to a beneficiary. And let the insurance company do the investigation at that time. And once they change that beneficiary and they've done their investigation, then the investor knows that that has already taken place. And as the previous Ms. Bungie testified, it's easy to distinguish a STOLI policy. They know when they get that request, as required by our law in 660A0787, they know that to change that policy, they can do the investigation at that time. Change that four-year limit and let them do that investigation at any time there's a change in beneficiary, and then the investor knows that the insurance company's investigated this and they're getting a good policy in the secondary market. We also think that changing the rules about contestability after the four-year limitation. We're talking about policies where a premium has been paid on a policy that was issued by an insurance company. I've been paying it now 6, 7, 8 years, and now they want to come back and allege insurable interest at the time at the inception of the policy. We think that that's wrong. We think you should look at changing that. We also think that there should be a non-judicial way to verify a policy. We should be able to, as a policyholder, we should have a right to communicate with the insurance company. There's two names on that insurance policy, ours and the insurance company's, and we should be able to have them verify the policy when we ask for that. They send us back a letter right now that says, "We only do that when the law requires it. Your law doesn't require it. Your next premium is due in a month." We think that's unfair. And lastly, I know that this is controversial for the industry, but this issue of premium return, Mr. Chairman, is simple contract law. If you're going to rescind a contract, you put the parties back where they belong. You don't get to take the premium,
Mr. Carlson,
and then rescind the policy.
Absolutely equal time. So leave your audience wanting more as well.
No. Mr. Chairman, I'm done. I conclude there, Mr. Chairman.
Nobody wants any more.
I am sincere, Mr. Chairman, about your efforts and those on the committee to try and look at this issue, because there is a group of policies that are out there. We don't want to hinder the current STOLI law or make it weaker. In fact, if they have efforts to make it stronger, we would be supportive of that. But we're talking about policies that have been issued by an insurance company that people are paying a premium on, and they should have some rights. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you, Ms. Rowan, and the folks that came to testify today. I do want to open it for questions. I also want to, part of what's prompting this is obviously this is a complex issue. That's one of the reasons we're hearing about it in the interim. And there's been discussion of potential floor amendments on other bills and things like that. It's not the kind of issue on which I want to deal with it as a floor amendment. And I think for members, you can now see why. that being said, is we can't keep members from doing it as floor amendments. So if there's a way, on behalf of myself, members of the committee, if there's some way for the two parties to come together and figure something, I think that'd be wonderful. If there's not, then I suspect we probably will see floor amendments, and we'll just hash it out on the floor of the House. With that, are there questions that members are burning to ask or needing to ask Representative David?
Thank you. Just really very brief. And, this is something we do need to keep a close eye on. I thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having this hearing today on this issue. And I would just say that something Mr. Carlson said basically would undo the STOLI law. So that's not a debate for today, but we need to be very careful about this.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Hopp?
I was going to say essentially the same thing. He said it better, so let it go.
And I don't think anybody would argue. I don't think anybody wants to undo the STOLI law. We'd ideally like to have a complex issue like this sorted out among the people that care about it. I appreciate, I think both sides, both here today and in previous meetings, have talked about markers and the factors and the variables and things that are important to, so hopefully we can have those discussions. I would add, Mr. Carlson, you were actually about 20 seconds over. Ms. Rowan, you got the final 20 seconds, whatever you want to say. And then I know absolutely that neither side can contend I took care of one better than the other. Any final words that you'd like to share?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And we will always look at any proposal that's put in front of us in the spirit of finding middle ground. This is a particularly difficult issue because of the perpetuation of fraud. Several of the things that Mr. Carlson mentioned would actually undo the Stolle Law and cause us great concern. But we will look at anything and happy to talk always.
And that's what we're hoping to hear.
And Mr. Chairman, you being on pay-per-view must really have your watch in.
Yeah. You're rolling another 8 seconds.
I get eight more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And our final and hottest topic of the day, right, is banking. Potential updating, rewriting of banking lending statutes. Where's everybody going? This is the best part. We've got, and I do try to abide by our mealtime rule here, so I appreciate folks' desire for brevity. We'll be done here by about noon. We do have five testifiers on this issue. Mark Cummins, who will come up first, and Mr. Skillbred from the ICBM, and then we've got folks here on behalf of the department, and then Mr. Martin as well from the Mortgage Association. Are Mr. Cummins and Mr. Skillbred, and just a little foreshadow before we take the testimony, I know that I had some role in prompting this. I give Representative Hoppe and Representative David's past chairs of this committee equal credit or blame for this discussion as well. Every chair of this committee at some point has said it would sure be nice to take a look at our banking and lending laws and make them a little simpler for people to understand. That's what this discussion is. I know it scares the crud out of everybody, and maybe, gentlemen, that's why we haven't had more discussions like this. I would like to hear from folks in the industry, but my point in bringing it forward was not to propose substantive changes to Minnesota's banking and lending laws, but simply to make them more clear, not just for the people that do them in the industry every day, but hopefully for the folks that, the consumers that are impacted by them. So we've got some folks who are going to give us a little background, Mr. Cummins, Mr. Skillbred, or Mr. Witt, or others. And then I did ask, specifically requested of the Commerce Department, give me some ideas on what you would do if you, and I know it didn't go through the vetting process with the governor and however the executive branch works, but in specific response to my request, they gave us some examples of a few things that they have that they think might help clarify certain areas. And I've asked them to share those with us today, as well as introduce Mr. Deal to the committee. And with that, I'm going to stop talking. We now have folks. Sir, if you could just identify yourself and share your comments. Welcome back, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Cummins. I'm president and CEO of the Minnesota Credit Union Network. The network represents Minnesota's 134 credit unions and their 1.6 million members. I appreciate the chairman and the Department of Commerce looking at ways that we can make updates and clarifications to our statutes and make them more understandable and easy to use. That said, the statute has served us well, and the banking statute, in which we also use as guidance, has done the same for us. The network has made some suggestions to Commerce that would improve or remove outdated and unnecessary language and reporting requirements from our statute. We appreciate the opportunity to keep the statute and update it, but we think that we can accomplish a lot with a simple tune-up rather than going out to buy a new car. That said, Mr. Chairman, that to be fair to the committee and brevity, glad to answer any questions or come back at them.
And that's very well put, Mr. Cummins. I think everybody, I don't think I've heard anybody that wants to throw the car out, but a little tune-up might is always an appropriate thing.
So is buying the car, or how we finance it?
Yeah. Dun-dun-dun. next up, is Mr. Skillbred here? Or Mr. Skillbred's representative? I'm just going from the list that my 6'6" committee administrator tells me to read. So, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tess Rice. I'm general counsel for the Minnesota Bankers Association. We represent about 400 banks in Minnesota, from the largest to the very smallest. We have always worked with the department in the past and with their bills, and they have
cleaned things up in the past. I went through the statutes myself. There was two chapters I went through to see if I could find any low-hanging fruit to help out here, and I didn't find much. I think there are some small items that could be clarified without too much difficulty, but I was not able to find anything significant that wasn't needed. You know, entire statutes, I couldn't find anything that could be removed. I just want to point out that we in the banking industry are dealing with significant regulatory changes right now. The Dodd-Frank Act, many of those provisions, the thousands of pages, are effective in January. And so our industry is scrambling to keep up with those. So we certainly would ask that nothing significant be changed at this time. But we're very willing to work with any group if you want to put together a task force or just want any input on changes. We're happy to help out in any way we can.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. And then finally up next, we've got Mr. Deal, the new Deputy Commissioner of Financial Institutions at the Department of Commerce, and Mr. Brickwitty, who I think all members on the committee are familiar with. Gentlemen, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. I'll introduce our new Financial Institutions Deputy Commissioner, Shane Deal, and have him give a 60-second bio of who he is and his time at the department.
Good morning, Chairman and committee members. Thank you for having me here today and recognizing that we're in a short time frame. I just wanted to more or less introduce myself. As you may know, I was appointed in May by Commissioner Rothman to the Deputy Commissioner of Financial Institutions within the Commerce Department. I come to the department with 20 years of financial institution experience and look forward to leading the department and working with this committee with any changes or discussions that we have as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deal. And Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman, we take our homework assignment seriously, and so as you reached out, as previous chairs have done, to have us take a look at the statutes, as members know, this is an area that is highly complex, and so looking at the regulatory statutes, which are complex, is a natural thing. Much like many of the other types of entities that we regulate, from insurance companies to utilities, many of the statutes are focused on the solvency and security of the financial institution so that consumers have protections and confidence in the system that we have. I think the Commerce Department would be, as we've heard from previous testifiers, happy to participate in a process, work collaboratively with both members and then also stakeholders, both industry and other members of the public who are interested. We think that the goals of any such process should be to avoid contentiousness and any unintended consequences if we decide to go down that road. One previous example that may be informative to members in that area is work that was done, I think, over 10 years ago now around the incorporation of corporations, which was an effort that involved the Revisor's Office, the Secretary of State's Office, as well as stakeholders in rewriting those chapters. So with regard to specific suggestions, we have a relatively modest list of for members to consider and for stakeholders to consider. I'm conscious of the Halloween being tomorrow, so I'm not trying to scare anybody with any of our suggestions. I think the four categories in which we were thinking about the assignment from you, Mr. Chairman, that we kind of bucket these suggestions into are around simplification, clarification, and technical issues. Looking at whether or not there are any consumer protections in modernization, and then we also reached out to the Revisor's Office, and they suggested perhaps taking a look to see if there are other federal preemption issues. So within those areas, I've got very small suggestions of things that we think could fit into those categories for members to consider. So in the simplification area, one example of that could be in Chapter 48.21, moving restrictions on real estate holdings for banks from 7 years to from the current level of five. This is an issue that the department deals with on a fairly regular basis. Requires applications from banks to the department, and such a change would allow banks more flexibility when they're making good faith efforts to dispose of their real estate holdings, but perhaps need more time to complete those transactions. In terms of the clarification technical corrections, I would highlight one in Chapter 118A. There's a contradiction within the law about whether or not credit unions are allowed to take public deposits. Certainly the intent of the legislature was that they could, but the law conflicts between the definition and the actual language of the statute in that section. So that's the type of thing that we would look at from a technical standpoint. The revisor's office indicated to us that, again, federal preemption might be an area where people, or a lens through which people could look at this project. One such area is 47.203, which has been superseded by Dodd-Frank, and could be examined for whether or not it is continued or its continued relevance in this in the state statute, as well as 48.512 subdivision 7C, which is an area in which the consumer protections inherent in that section are now in the federal code, and could also be examined potentially about what the impact would be if it were to be removed from the state statute. One broader area in terms of consumer protection and modernization, and it was interesting to be on the schedule with the folks from the lottery this morning, because this is a similar type of area that we would be interested in having some broader conversations with stakeholders about, is the area of ATM modernization. As a technology, ATMs, as many of you are aware, are becoming more interactive and offering more services to consumers. I know that the ATM closest to the Commerce Department in the Skyway in St. Paul, I can buy stamps and other things, I think even bus tickets out of at this point. And so as they become more interactive, the statute...
Are there lottery tickets available at these...
Mr. Chairman, not yet, but you could see where there might be some consumer protections needed in that area if that was to come into play. And so I think we would be interested in working with people to look at what other states are doing to modernize their state laws in terms of education and notification to consumers, requirements for property owners, and auditing requirements. But in the department's view, that should be done with an eye on preserving the consumer protections that are inherent in our current law while modernizing the statute to accommodate new technologies coming into the field. So with Mr. Chairman, I'm grateful to you for, I'm sure you have our standard caveat disclosure about needing to go through the governor's office process before the department can actually have an official position on any of these items or any items on this area. I'm sure you have that memorized at this point. So thank you for giving it, and I'll sort of reiterate that, but happy to work with you and stakeholders on projects in this area if the committee would like that to be something that we work on this session or in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. And you're right. I think all members of the committee are aware that it puts you guys in a little bit of an uncomfortable position when we ask you to do something that you haven't run through the legislative vetting process. We acknowledge that you have not done that at this point, but I appreciate your responsiveness to my request. We still have Mr. Martin. Before you guys go, though, unless members of the committee were to disagree, what I'm hoping to see is for you folks to sit down with the bankers and the credit unions and others who might be interested. You've got a long history of whether it's a formal task force or not, but of that working for you. We've evinced a desire by the credit union folks, the bankers, to be part of that discussion. If you guys are cool doing that, either if you want to make it formal, you can make it formal. Something informal is fine. At the end of the day, what I'm hoping to end up with is something that former chairman, minority lead, Representative Hoppe, and I could carry together. Whether it's formally an unsession kind of proposal or not, I don't really care, but the aim being to simplify without changing substantively. And that seems to be the path that you've... One caveat, by the way, I do think that there will be substantive changes proposed relative specifically to payday lending. I've heard from any number of folks that have talked about a desired... I consider that a separate discussion. And I didn't want folks walking out of this room saying, well, there's going to be no substantive changes in the world of lending or banking, because I do expect that there's going to be very substantive proposals in that area. So, gentlemen, thank you. Unless there's questions, Representative
Hoppe. Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I want a good hearing today, I think, and I think I'd like to hear more about banking and kind of all the related issues, especially as how you guys and the bankers and the credit unions think Dodd-Frank is going to have an impact on Minnesota, particularly rural Minnesota, as it continues to unfold. And I do think it's something that it'd be nice to work on a bipartisan basis. So, and it's just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why we left it for last. I mean, we wanted to have a rousing finish. I mean, with so let's, Mr. Martin, are you still, there you are. You were over here for a while. Now, this is,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're the big wrap-up.
I mean, let's, you have fireworks or something that you're going to have with you at the...
Mr. Chairman, last and hopefully fastest here, and Pat Martin with the Minnesota Mortgage Association, ditto all of the talk about depreciation and cooperation and help and all of that sort of thing. But 30 seconds on a Minnesota housing update. Rates up a little, down a couple of basis points this week. Refinancings down. That's why you're seeing in the newspaper certain banks discharging employees. Housing starts and housing sales. Sawtooth generally up. Foreclosures down. So that's sort of a brief on the Minnesota housing market. As far as rewriting the laws are concerned, I don't have a proposal to review yet, so I'm not quite sure what I'm talking about, but that has never stopped me from testifying in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, and we've got Mr. Skilbred. I tried finding you earlier, Mr. Skilbred. You must be the one with the fireworks, because you're going to be our final word today. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Relations with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. I was wearing my invisible cape there. That's why you couldn't see. I'm getting ready for Halloween, you know. Mr. Chairman and members, I'd just like to say that with respect to the proposal before us to simplify without substantive changes except in one area or two perhaps, we'll be happy to work with the department and work with the committee to do that. There are likely some things that could be cleaned up, and probably most importantly to us would be whether or not the federal changes recently made conflict or comply or are ambiguous with what we have in our statutes right now. That would be a very tough thing to determine. So if I provide any comment that might be helpful, it might be to just kind of go slow and make sure you have the right folks in the room. And one group that I think would be a good group to have in the room would be some representatives from the Minnesota State Bar. With that, I'll close.
Thank you, Mr. I think, members, that's a pretty good sum up. We've took us 155 years to get to this point of banking and lending laws. I don't think we're going to try to do it quickly. We're going to try to do it right. So, Mr. Skilbred, thank you. Members, thank you. A couple of reminders. Due to some conflicts, we had a tour that was set for later today that's been canceled but will be rescheduled. And then Chris said make sure you pass in your blue forms. Representative Hoppe?
Mr. Chair, I was thinking about this a minute ago when we were talking about banking, which I maybe is not getting into the banking details, maybe not the most excited. I would like to have another hearing on that. And I don't know what your thoughts are. You and I are on the MNsure Oversight Committee. Could we have a committee hearing kind of touching on MNsure, but how it's rolling out around the state and things like that sometime in the near future, if that's acceptable to the chair?
I mean, actually, Representative Hoppe, you read my mind. I'm not sure the timing. We're now getting into that holiday period where it becomes difficult to schedule anything. Yeah, I want to bring that back. We also talked, Mr. Kwapik talked about, this was the original committee, I think, that the stadium bill came out of, and it might be nice for an update on that as well. So, folks, with that, unless there's anything else, we stand adjourned. Thank you. It's great to see everybody.